Hello, I'm Mike McCone, and you're listening to the Justice League Bwahaha podcast. You want to make something of it?
This episode, Justice League America number 32, in Justice League Europe number 8, cover dated November 1989. Hello, and welcome to the 32nd episode of Justice League International Bwahaha Podcast, a proud member of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. My name's Ear Damel Shag, and I am your host, but I'm not doing it alone. Thankfully, I'm going to be joined by two friends to help me cover these issues. We're going to chat with my second co-host in a little bit, but for now, my first co-host today, well, basically, this guy's resume is going to make you sick. He's been a playwright, an actor, a director, and for 5 years, he was a talk radio host for iHeartRadio. Nowadays, he spends much of his time slumming with some comic book hack named Mike Grell. I don't know. I've never heard of him. And our guest today acts as editor-in-chief of Mike Grell's new publishing endeavor, Masterstroke Studios. He's also written and published a comic book for kids about young Robin Hood. And finally, he's developing a new video series featuring tons of comic creators such as Neil Adams, Colleen Durham, Carl Kessel, Tom Grummett, and many more. Even Keith Giffen and J.M. DeMatteis. Again, never heard of those last two hacks. Folks, please help me begrudgingly welcome Mr. Jeff Messer. Welcome to the New York Embassy, Jeff. Thanks for being here, buddy. How you doing?
Hey, Shag. It is absolutely my pleasure to be here. And let me just say, I think the last time I had an irredeemable Shag was sometime back in college. So I'm feeling really nostalgic right now. They've all been redeemable ever since.
Perfect. You know. I'm really glad to hear that for you.
How you doing? It's so good to be here, man.
I'm so thrilled you're here. I mean, we've talked about this a long time ago. Oh my gosh, your life has been through a whole sea change since we started down this path of working together.
I feel like I listened to the very first episode of this show, and I think I emailed you within the week after that, and you had said, oh, the next available slot is like 3 years from now, and here we are.
Forgetting all those unsubscribes I sent you back first. Go away. And then my friends at Sutherland's vouch for you, then I was willing to talk to you.
Well, you see, here's the thing is that stalking is an effective method for getting what you want. Hey, look, the first comic book I ever got as a kid was drawn by Mike Grell. Now I've stalked him enough that he's actually letting me work with him on new projects. See, stalking works.
So tell me a little bit about that. All right, so you're working with Masterstroke Studios, right?
Yes, yes. I'm one of the founders, in fact, of Masterstroke Studios with Mike Grell and another comic book luminary named Arvel Jones.
Oh, gee, seriously? Wow. Okay. Yep.
Arvel is a part of this, and the main kind of focus of it is people like Mike and Arvel, and there are plenty of guys who are in that older generation of creators who may not be getting as much work from DC and Marvel as they used to, outside of the odd cover here and there, or maybe, you know, Mike just had something in Young Justice that featured a crossover with the Warlord, and he did 5 pages in a variant cover.
Nice.
A lot of these guys have creator-owned characters that they came out with in the 80s. Mike especially was very prolific with some of his creator-owned properties, and finding somebody to publish them and actually pay him to create things is getting harder and harder. And through a couple of years of conversations with Mike, as I got to know him and become really close friends with him, I kept saying, you know, you should look at what somebody like Ron Randall is doing on Patreon and Kickstarter. And you know, there are these different ways that you can directly connect with your fan base, fund the projects that you want to do, and have enough time to do them the right way. And he finally was like, you know what? I don't understand anything that you just said to me, but it sounds really good. Let's get some heads together and see what we can come up with. And so last year, we brought back his character, Maggie the Cat, who was a spinoff from his John Sable character from the early 80s. Mm-hmm. We did a 64-page single edition, kind of a bigger book on Kickstarter, raised over $30,000 to publish it. And, you know, we're working on various different projects, looking forward to what unfolds in 2020 and beyond. You know, it's one of those things where I pinch myself. I'm like, I can't believe that the kid in me, and, you know, you and I are close to the same age. So, when, you know, being a teenager in the 80s and reading comic books and stuff, and to go, these people were canonized in my mind, people like Mike Grell, and to go, hey, I've got him on my speed dial, and he's now a personal friend of mine, a really, really close friend. So, yeah, anyway.
That is absolutely amazing. I mean, it's so gratifying to see amazing artists who, like you said, aren't getting as much work from the big companies that they should, getting out there to their fans, being successful, and getting their product out there again. And I think that's absolutely wonderful. And by the way, Mike did contact me before recording, and he did ask if you would slow down on the sexting, since he gave you his number, but I think there's a line that he just wanted to draw there. So I hope
I will say that the first picture I sent was an accident.
Oh my God. Stop now.
But the rest have been sincere.
Oh my gosh. Well, I've met Mike a couple of times at conventions, and he's always so incredibly nice and such a wonderful guy. And on behalf of the fandom, I thank you for your contribution in helping him get back out there.
Oh, man, it's my pleasure. I hope we can do as much as humanly possible. As long as the fans continue to support it, we'll keep going.
So along the same lines of stalking famous creators that I adore, I understand you've been pestering lots of other creators at various comic conventions and making them do, mugshots and sworn testimonies. Is that right?
Once I convinced Mike that I wasn't dangerous or insane, criminally insane or otherwise, and got into his good graces, I thought, hey, this worked out pretty well. As I said before, stalking is a perfectly effective means of making new friends, especially in the comic book industry. It's kind of funny. I worked with a producer friend of mine who does film work. We had a couple of projects that we were talking about doing that never really got off the ground because it's a miracle anything gets made in the film industry, ever. Just it really is.
Totally believe that.
And so the couple of things we tried to do never really, came about. And he asked me one day, he's like, hey, do you have any other good ideas for something that would be, cheap and easy to film? And cheap and easy are words that I really kind of identify with. So I said to him just off the cuff, and this had been in my head for a little while because I had a podcast. When I was on radio, I did a side podcast called the Geek Brain Popcast. For a couple of years when I was with IR Radio, I would steal studio time and do a little podcast show. And I thought, something like that, but bigger. And I said, hey, what about Inside the Actor's Studio, but with comic book creators? And my producer friend, his eyes lit up like a Christmas tree. And he's like, that's brilliant. Let's do it. And a few months later, suddenly he calls me and says, hey, we're going to go to a con and we're going to shoot as many interviews as we can. And I'm like, wait, what? You took me seriously? And so after that, we did a test weekend at a con and it went really, really well.
I'm just saying, blue index cards or GTFO,
We have our own branded index cards that we use. Okay.
Fair enough.
It has the Issues With logo, and that's the name of the show that I came up with. It's called Issues With.
Bruce Wayne would approve of the on-point marketing. Well done.
Yes, exactly. And if you need a little subheading, it's called A Panel Discussion. We just lean right into the comic book lingo.
Nice.
So the idea is Inside the Actor's Studio, but with creators that you might know them and you might know their work. And it's very much like my relationship with Mike Grell. The more I got to know him, I got asked to write a book about him for Tomorrow's Publishing a couple of years ago, which came out in 2018 and was nominated for an Eisner in 2019. And it's more insanity in my life.
Congratulations.
Thank you. I didn't win, but hey, I got to go and it was nice.
You got nominated. You got nominated one more time than me. So that's fantastic.
Yes. You got time. But I will tell you, I'm planning on going back because there's nothing more addictive than going the first time.
Oh,
yeah,
okay.
It's pretty insane. But, the thing about the Issues With show is we decided to go to Heroes Con in Charlotte, worked out a deal with them, set up 12 interviews, and we shot an entire season last summer. 12 episodes, 12 hours with people like, you mentioned some of them, Neil Adams, Colleen Doran, Carl Kiesel, Tom Grummet, Ron Randall, a couple of guys named Giffen and DeMatteis were there. And it was pretty sweet. Can't wait to share. We're in the post-production process now and planning to shoot season 2 this summer at Heroes Con. So between now and then, hopefully these episodes will be ready and out for mass consumption somehow, somewhere. So look for it.
Well, when they're out, let us know and we'll be sure to push that out through our JLI social media.
Absolutely. And I appreciate that.
Oh, fantastic. Well, we could sit here and chat about this stuff all day, but we'd probably need to get rolling through some of this other stuff. For example, we need to thank our sponsors. Folks, this episode of the JLI podcast is sponsored in part by InStockTrades.com. InStock Trades is your best online source for trades, hardcovers, and other collected editions, all for up to 42% off with free shipping for orders of $50 or more. Now, each episode, we're going to select a collected edition to briefly discuss from the In-Stock Trades library. Usually be tied into this month's JLI issue in some way, shape, or form. And I leaned into the whole Adam Hughes thing this time. So I picked Ghost Omnibus Trade Paperback Volume 1. Now, this collects the earliest appearances of the character Ghost from Dark Horse's Comics Greatest World. You may remember from the 1990s when everybody was launching their own superhero universe. And if you don't remember Ghost, she was a spectral Avenger. But what she was really known for was being smoking hot, because most of her illustrations were done by Terry Dodson and Adam Hughes. And so it's a story of a woman who was killed, and she's trying to find out why. It was actually very entertaining. I read quite a few of them. And right now, you can get this omnibus on In-Stock Trades. It's 352 pages, full color. In addition to Adam Hughes and Terry Dodson, you're getting several other artists, because a number of different people worked on that series. And it's full color, normally retails for $24.95, but you can get it for 42% off. It's only $14.47. Again, I've read several of these stories, thought it was really engaging, one of the better titles in the world's greatest comics. And you can get it out there in In-Stock Trades. Now, Jeff, the way this works is normally the guests bring something, and when they don't, I have to edit it out because it gets really embarrassing because they didn't. You don't seem like a very prepared guy. But any chance you brought something?
I did. And first of all, let me say, Ghost, I remember seeing it. I don't remember reading it, but that happens with a lot of Adam Hughes books. I can attest to what Shag just said, so go and check that out and get it. I went for In-Stock Trades. They have Before Watchmen trade paperback, a combination of Night Owl and Dr. Manhattan. These were the miniseries that DC put out that nobody asked for about 10 years ago. And they've got some big name talent to come and do it, which means that they have blackmail photos on just about everyone.
Very true.
Yeah, and the Dr. Manhattan one was written by J. Michael Straczynski and drawn by Mr. Adam Hughes, which actually should automatically help balance the scales between the cheesecake that he's known for with the beefcake, because, of course, Adam Hughes got to draw Dr. Manhattan and his impressive blue wang. So. So that kind of silences all those people who are like, he's just a good girl artist. It's like, no. In fact, I think I saw a sketch he did somewhere of Power Girl pointing or looking at Dr. Manhattan, and Dr. Manhattan going, hey, the eyes are up here. But anyway, regularly this book is $19.99, but you get it at 42% off. That is $11.59, which is a steal, but do pay for it because, well, we don't want to encourage the wrong kind of behavior. Now, mind you, I would have picked my personal favorite Adam Hughes book, The Maze Agency, but in stock, ironically, didn't have it in stock. So I had to go with the Before Watchmen. So there it is.
Shocking that it's not in publication at this point.
I have several copies. I may have all of them.
Folks, well, for these and all your trade paperback needs, please visit InStockTrades.com. Folks, this episode is also sponsored in part by your help through Patreon. Because, you know, running the Fire & Water Podcast Network with all the shows and various online hosting can be rather expensive. So you guys have really stepped up to the plate and have really helped us with your support. And really, if you're interested in supporting the JLI podcast, this really is the best way to do it. So if you go out to Patreon.com/FW Podcast and take a look at what's out there and just consider supporting the Fire & Water Podcast Network. And when you support us on Patreon, at certain levels, you get recognition on your favorite shows. For example, these folks asked to be recognized on the JLI podcast. Bill from the Bat Pod, Chris Lewis, Devin Clancy, Martin Gray, Max Traver, Rudy Castillo, Sean Ross, Tim Price, David Gutierrez, and Gord Tolden. Again, folks, please check out our Patreon at patreon.com/FW podcasts. Now, we need your help right now, folks. I want you going on the social media, use our hashtag FW podcast, tag us at JLI podcast. I want to hear what you think about the Teasdale Imperative, what you think about Justice League America, Adam Hughes, Jeff's really creepy obsession with Mike Grell, you know, anything that comes to mind. And we want your thoughts on JLI because that's what this is. This is all about building a community of online JLI fans around this show. And we need your help to do that. So please go out there and let us hear your thoughts. Now, speaking of hearing thoughts, this is the part where Jeff gets to talk some more because goodness gracious, he hasn't done it enough already. Jeff, what is your personal origin story with the JLI? How'd you find the book and what made you fall in love with it?
Well, you know, here's my thing is that I go back to the early 80s with all those great JLA crossovers between Earth 1, Earth 2, you know, the Earth 3 supervillains. Every year there was a great crossover. I don't think I bought any of the books except for the crossover Wars for whatever reason for a number of years. So I was always interested in the Justice League somewhat. I missed the Detroit era. Not sad about it. Don't regret it a bit.
This is not a safe place to hate on the Detroit era, sir.
I just said I'm not sad about it.
I will say Crisis on Earth Prime is what made me a JLA fan to start with.
Oh, well, hey, excellent. Good stuff. Whatever gets you through the door, as they would.
Exactly. First taste is free, kid, or 50 cents.
I love the Crisis on Infinite Earths, but more sacrilege coming down the pipe here. I did not like the miniseries Legends that came out, so I was kind of...
Folks, thanks for having Jeff on the show. Y'all have a good night. Coming up next, Justice League Europe.
There we go. Just cut it short. I apologize. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to trigger anybody out there. I know we live in sensitive times.
But Paul Schaefer's playing you off the stage.
There you go. But I really didn't care for that as much. And so the spinout of Legends, which led us to the new Justice League, really didn't register for me until I saw issue number 8 on the newsstand. I think this is the entry drug for a lot of people, was the Moving Day book, because you look at it and go, this can't be right. That looks really ridiculous. And then you pick it up and start flipping through it. And then the first thing that impressed me was, of course, Black Canary on the cover. But then I opened it and then I thought, man, who is this artist? Where did this guy come from? And I impulse bought the book, went home and read it, and quickly went and got the back issues, followed it from that point forward. I think McGuire is a once in an era kind of artist, that there's none before him that are like him, and there are none after him that are like him, even though people try. And he really was the gateway in for me. I knew Keith Giffen because I was a Legion fan, and so I was much more receptive to it. And we're talking about a dark period, Dark Knight, Watchmen, all that stuff.
Oh, yeah.
This was a funny book, as my grandfather would call them back in the day. And it was smart, and it was a smart, funny book. So I really fell for it. And especially when McGuire was gone, I had trouble with that because he was such a singular talent. But I met Adam Hughes at Heroes Con in 1988.
Wow.
And nobody knew who he was. he was just this young upstart guy. And I met him there, and I saw him again in 89. And this is June of 89. Of course, he started, August of 89 was the first issue of the Justice League that came out?
Somewhere in that range. I don't remember the cover date would have been October, but that would have meant, probably came out around August or so.
Yep. So between the first year I met him and the next year, he had gotten a gig, but no one knew who he was. You could get an Adam Hughes sketch for $15.
Right. He wasn't Adam Hughes yet.
Exactly. And this was back in the day when artists would work on their day job at cons because they had a lot of spare time, not like today. And Adam had pages of the first issue of his Justice League.
Oh my gosh.
And he was sitting there and he was doing work and we could flip through his book and you could see them and all that. Just a super nice guy, just tremendously fun guy. When he took over the book, I was like, this guy is different than Kevin Maguire, but is every bit as great as Kevin Maguire. So I've been an Adam Hughes fan since day one.
That's fantastic. Wow, what a great story. It's always nice to connect with an artist in the early days and then come back and find out, that they've gone on to do amazing things and stuff that you love. And
Yeah, cool dude.
That's awesome. Well, why don't we get into this? Why don't we celebrate some of what Adam has done here? Folks, you can go out to our website, which is firewaterpodcast.com, where we're going to post some of the images from this issue. Now, I'm not going to post a lot because, let's face it, you can buy the old physical copies. You can get the trade paperbacks. You can get the upcoming omnibus. I guess this one's in the first omnibus. You can get it on DC and Universe. There's a million places you can read this thing. If you don't have access to it, you're a fool. You're a fool, I tell you. So get out there, find your copy. If not, you can see a couple of pages we'll talk about. Anyway, folks, this is Justice League America number 32 by DC Comics, cover date of November 1989, on the shelf September 12th, 1989. Cover price $1 for shiny quarters. And the cover's by Adam Hughes and Joe Rubenstein, and just the second issue that Hughes is doing. So if you saw him working on that first book, this is the next one he would have been doing a month later, which is just crazy to think about. Why don't you describe the cover for the folks at home?
Well, it's a great cover. A lot of stuff going on here. A mad mob is trying to take down some of our heroes, of course, featuring Batman, Animal Man. Go ahead, Shaq. There we go. And Mr. Miracle. You wouldn't know it was Adam Hughes necessarily, just to look at it. Doesn't have any of his later day trademark kind of Adam Hughes-isms to it, but it's just a nice solid cover that makes you want to know what's going on inside the book. I mean, I look at Batman, I do dig the fact that he's getting taken down by a little kid who's just like all over him.
Right.
That's pretty funny. And he's looking like he's struggling mightily against this tiny child.
With the pigtails.
The pigtails flying around all over the place.
I got to point out something about that, because are you you looking at the physical copy or the digital copy right now?
I have the physical copy in front of me.
Okay, I'm looking at both.
Okay.
And on the digital version, they have recolored the cover just slightly. Because if you look at the girl's ring finger, right, there is a little weirdness with the coloring there. Turns out that part of that ring finger is supposed to be digging into his eyeball.
Oh, so the coloring was a little off on the...
Yeah.
Okay.
So the tip of the finger that you're seeing there in flesh tone is not actually that. That's actually his cowl. Yeah, she is digging her ring finger into his freaking eyeball. That kid is sick and vicious.
No wonder he looks upset. Wow. I don't blame him a bit.
Right.
And I also love the... Here's a great thing. I love this era because you see the fabric of the bat suit. This is long before the rubber and nipples era of Batman. So you see the stress of the cloth as these people are clawing at him. And of course, we get Mr. Miracle looking oddly constipated over there on the side. Who knows? His disposition in the story might inform that a little bit, too. And Animal Man just looking like Animal Man, hanging out with Batman and Mr. Miracle. It's all in all, it's a good cover. I wouldn't say it's a great cover, but it's a good cover.
Well, I like that it's consistent with what McGuire used to do, which would be there's a lot of focus on characters' faces.
Yep.
There's activity, but the background is a solid color, because that was something that McGuire started early in the issues and kept carrying through, was the covers would be very plain in the background, so the characters would pop off of it. And here, they've chosen to give it a really dark background, which really gives you that sense of night, which makes sense with the, with these zombie vampire attacking and all that. So I think that's very effective.
Totally on point. You're right. It could be a McGuire cover very easily.
And I really like Batman's... Not only is that girl digging into his face, at the same time, he is kicking a dude, squaring the face to the point where there's actually splatter coming out of his mouth or off where the blow is with his foot. Just so gross. Oh my gosh. And you mentioned Animal Man. That always makes me happy. Just seeing Animal Man on the cover of any Justice League comic brings me joy. It always does. But the most important thing to walk away with here is something that I think it was talked about last episode, which is the difficulty for superheroes to be fighting regular people, because that's what's happening here. Yes, they're acting like crazy zombies or whatever, but they're not superpowered. And how much do you hurt? How much do you fight back when you could easily kill them? So, you know, they go up against Amazo. Sure, they can unload their whole arsenal. Go up against Joe Schmo, the CPA. Well, he's probably going to go down with one punch. Do you want to hit him that hard? So I feel like it conveys that.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Well, as you get into this, folks, you get a plot and layout by Keith Giffen, script by J.M. DeMatteis. Penciler is Adam Hughes. Woo! Inker is Art Nichols. Letters, Bob LePan. Colorist is Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor, Kevin Dooley. And editor, Andy Helfer. The issue itself is called Breaking Point. Why don't you start us off?
All right. We open on the very first page. We see a professor. I guess he's a professor, right? Teasdale.
Yep. I don't know if he actually has a class where he teaches, but they call him professor.
That's right. Yes. Professor Teasdale, looking like I'm going to say this, and the early pages, he looks a little bit like a mad scientist version of Phil Collins circa the mid-1980s No Jacket Required era, with that long, long hair and kind of the flop sweaty look.
I'm with you.
Okay. good. I hope I'm not the only one that sees that. But anyway, so in the beginning, he is monologuing in true supervillain fashion. In fact, he gets to the point where he almost laughs maniacally and then thinks better of it, which is a nice internal monologue. But funnily enough, it is his laugh is a nyahaha laugh, which I guess that's the Eastern European version of wahaha, I guess.
Well, I think what we're learned here is that the NY signifies bad guy, whereas BW signifies good guy. And it's pretty straightforward.
Good. There we go.
See,
excellent.
See if you can keep up, Jeff.
I will. Absolutely. So he unleashes catapult style, a canister of more of this bad mojo that's turning people into zombie vampires. And the next page, we see John and Captain Atom being very stoic and general-like before the battle. Then Ralph interrupts them for a little panic, as only Ralph can do. And everyone springs into action. So we get Captain Atom and Power Girl flying through the air, trading barbs, and then suddenly the canister goes flying by and explodes on the ground. So everybody scrambles. Batman, Booster, Beetle, they're all wearing their NATO protective suits. Beetle is complaining the whole time, which is kind of the only thing he does in this entire crossover, it seems. He seems to be kind of the sour egg in this group. I don't know what's up with him. And it doesn't get much to do, which I'm kind of disappointed. So anyway, it's going kind of badly because the people who don't have protective suits, meaning the soldiers, are being infected. So everybody has to pull back. So they all retreat back to 15 miles away. Teasdale then encounters the Gray Man, and they form an uneasy alliance, as two supervillains would. The JL team regroup. Batman determines that the whole thing is man-made, but he wonders who and why. So it remains a mystery. He said the M word, so that gets Ralph's nose twitching, which puts Beetle into a twitchy kind of mood because he finds that to be a little on the gross side. and I guess we would too. If we saw somebody's nose switching like that, why not? It would be a little disgusting. And I have to say, then there is probably my favorite page, a gorgeous page by Adam Hughes, where Mr. Miracle, kind of on the down and out side of things, is alone thinking to himself. Power Girl joins him. They have a nice moment. The artwork here is really splendid with the shadows and the light and everything. Mm-hmm. It really is a beautiful page. And then a helicopter arrives, and it turns out that it is a Stagg Industries helicopter carrying Simon Stagg. Of course, Rex goes a little ballistic. He's not happy about this. And so we find out that, well, Stagg reveals that the gas that was infecting these people that created this horde was made at his factory, and the horde is now marching toward that very same factory. Teasdale walking among the horde, gloating and monologuing all along the way, but he notes that there is a degenerative effect to the gas, and it's causing some of the horde to falter. Teasdale, no less motivated to move on, and sets us up for an extended flashback. Now, Shag, since you are yourself a relic of the past, the flashback seems like a perfect place for you to take over, right up your alley.
I take my walker over there, and I accept the baton from you, so thank you.
I'm a relic from the past, too, so it's all good.
Exactly. So we get that flashback, and we know it is a flashback, because, of course, rounded corners. Uh-huh. And it's all from Teasdale's perspective. And the reader learns that while working for Stagg Industries, Teasdale created the gas that changes people into these mindless slaves, and then it later kills them. Now, Simon Stagg was thrilled with this because of the military potential of the gas, and he ordered live testing on an unwitting European village. Once it proved successful, Stagg intended for Teasdale to be killed. However, Teasdale survived thanks to the actions of the Gray Man, who made a deal with him. Teasdale would make more zombies, and thus the Gray Man would get more power to break free of the Lords of Order. Gosh, a Gray Man going evil. Never thought of that. Unfortunately, the Justice League teams don't know any of this. Simon Stagg only told them that Teasdale was an unstable scientist that worked for Stagg Industries, and that Teasdale was responsible for the accident that's affecting the European villages. Meanwhile, in another dimension, the Spectre and the new female Dr. Fate confront the Lords of Order, but the Lords of Order insist on neutrality due to the coming Kali Yuga. Now, the two heroes defy the cosmic entities, determined to halt the Gray Man's path of destruction. Then back in Europe, as the zombie horde marches towards Stagg Industries, the two Justice League teams prepare the defenses for the plant. The Justice League believes that Teasdale wants revenge, but the reality is that Teasdale wants the enormous storage container of more vampire gas that Simon Stagg has been hiding. The issue ends with the zombie horde storming the Stagg Industries perimeter. Then it says, next, in Justice League Europe number 8, the conclusion of our somewhat epic tale featuring Dr. Fate and the Spectre in final combat with the Gray Man. Be there or be square. And then as you go further into the issue, you get another next issue box, which says, you asked for it! Who says we don't pay attention to you? A slugfest galore with Guy Gardner and, well, let's just say an old acquaintance. Beetle and Booster make a financial expedition to Kuhi Kuhi Kuhui from JLI Annual number 3. Remember? Kind of funny that they don't think anyone remembers, because now here we sit, you know, 30 years later, and that's all anyone remembers is Kuhi Kuhui. Yeah. Anyway, and a certain King of the Seven Seas flops in, and it ain't Charlie Tuna. And then beneath that, there's an ad showing Guy Gardner, and the tagline says, nitwits, knuckleheads, and poozers. So, folks, you know who's coming next issue. All right, let's get into this. What'd you think, man?
Well, I hadn't read this entire storyline in probably 30 years, I would say. Maybe not even once since it came out. And, of course, I was devoutly into the Justice League. I was fresh out of high school at the point that this came out, so my sense of humor was still reasonably juvenile enough to really kind of lean heavily into the Booster and Beetle relationship, if you will.
So you're implying if someone still finds Beetle and Booster funny, then they're basically the mindset of a 16-year-old. What are you telling me?
Pretty close, yeah. And I'm okay with that, because I still find them funny in a different sort of, oh, those guys kind of way, you know?
I'll own that. That's fine.
Yeah, it's nostalgic, not necessarily relatable, let's say. And, you know, and it's tough because we know so much of where the characters go from here. The next issue, of course, is a defining moment for those two characters, and I would say maybe one of their finest moments as a dynamically dubious duo, if you will.
I was wondering where you're going with that. Yeah, that works. Yeah.
Yeah. The shenanigans, if you will, kind of hit peak Booster and Beetle next issue, next story arc. And you know, this issue, not so much. These guys don't get a lot to do in this whole story arc for the most part. And I'm kind of disappointed disappointed with that. But I do really enjoy the one page with Power Girl and, you know, Mr. Miracle having that moment, which is kind of a nice sincere moment. Not really any comedy to be had there. And it may just be because of the art and the way that it looks. I think Adam Hughes has a real command of this, and it only gets better from here. In fact, I see, and I don't know how you feel about this, I see less Giffen layout influence at this point in the book than back in the day when McGuire was there, because I none of these pages look like McGuire would really do them.
That's fair.
They don't really fit. And I especially, that's why I gravitate to this one page with Mr. Miracle and Power Girl, because this would have been rows of talking head boxes back in the day. But here, you know, the first panel is you see, you know, Mr. Miracle, you know, the full figure, but it's small. And you see this large kind of side profile of his head and shadows. And I look at this and I go, yeah, this is its own thing now. It still works, but it's kind of like, wow, this, look at how this is evolving. And I'm kind of impressed by that.
I'm going to challenge you a bit. I would say it's probably more half and half, because like a page like this, you're right, does not look like a typical Giffen page at all, especially like that first panel where you've got the giant Mr. Miracle face in the background. And then in the foreground is a little tiny, you know, full figure of him, and the coloring, especially setting those off as opposed to the opposite of what you would expect. So I would say that that page definitely is not Giffen-ish. But if you go later on, you get like during the flashback, you get 9-panel grids.
Oh, yeah.
When the Spectre and Dr. Fate are in the Lords of Order realm, that looks very Giffen. So I think they're somewhere in the middle, probably.
Yeah, true enough. Yeah.
Interestingly enough, you can kind of get a sense, because there's certain pages that don't have many butt shots, and those seem to be the ones that are not trademark Giffen. So I think there's something to that, because Giffen loves his butt shots.
He does, and so does Adam Hughes, but just not yet.
Right. Well, that's a whole different level of cheesecake.
Oh, boy. Hughes. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Maybe Giffen did it. Maybe Giffen corrupted him.
That page, I just call it the blue page.
Yeah.
Page 9 is absolutely stunning. Yeah. It's because Power Girl is very muted. I mean, yeah, she's chesty or whatever, but that's not the focus of the page. It's more of soft lighting on her face and her hair and the discussion. The page is trying to tell you something. It's trying to tell you that Mr. Miracle feels hopeless.
Right.
And he feels like this is not where he belongs. And you really it's very sad. It's very melancholy.
It really is. And in the midst of a story like this, you know, you kind of need that, because this is a darker story arc, you know, than we're possibly used to as Justice League fans. I sort of found, and I know this is sacrilege to say, I sort of found the attempts at making fun of themselves or being funny. This time reading it through, I felt, wow, it's sort of shoehorned into this story that I think could stand alone without it. But the book itself is known for having kind of the yuck-yucks. And so I was like, oh, did they feel obliged to have to insert, you know, the Beatles snoring thing and you know, repeated instances of, hey, we're the Justice League. It's like, yeah, but we're not that good kind of one-liners, which there are several of them in this issue. I don't know. I had mixed feelings about it looking back, reading it now after all this time.
It's interesting because this issue, because, you know, it's part of a bigger tapestry, all written by the same guys.
Yeah.
That the previous JLA issue, which was very much a character piece in the embassy as they're getting ready for this crossover.
Yeah.
And it's genuinely hilarious. And
it
the
is.
Humor comes out of the situations. So you're right. I can see what you're saying here, that some of the jokes here feel kind of tacked on. Now, there is one that I particularly like, which does become my blah-ha-ha comment, so I'm not going to mention it now, but there is one that I feel is not a tacked-on joke. It feels like it works better with the story, but I see what you're saying, though. Like, even where Ralph's nose is twitching, and they make the gag about, oh, you know, my wife likes it, and they say, no, that's not what I hear, which is a funny bit that's been repeating over in Justice League Europe over and over, so it's funny to see it here in America, but even that, you're right, you could have removed that from the art, and you wouldn't know you were missing it.
Yeah, yeah, and I agree, and I sort of feel like, you know, there's a couple of moments, let me see if I can find one of them specifically. The thing with Captain Adam and John talking, you know, about, you know, you love a good cliche, don't you, John, and that sort of thing. I was like, you know, I feel like they could have had a better conversation as the two, you know, leaders of the two teams than trying to have the comedic banter. It felt a little out of place. I don't know.
Oh, so you touched on one of the ones I like. That's not my wah-ha-ha moment, but I like that one because one of the things I like best about Justice League is when they do a joke and then they do the callback to the joke.
Yes.
I think it works well. So I felt like that one was actually structured better than some of the others. But, you know.
True,
it's okay that you're wrong. That's not a problem.
I'm used to it. I'm married.
We all understand that.
Yes, absolutely. But yeah, I enjoy it. There's a lot of nostalgia that comes along with it because of my connection to having seen Adam Hughes at the point that he was starting this book and having known him as an unknown. I sort of feel like I'm in on the ground floor of a secret that people were yet to discover. So it's very nostalgic to go back and take a look at it for sure.
And one of the things I think is impressive too is as you can watch Adam Hughes grow and evolve while he's on this book too.
Yeah.
Because these early days, especially this storyline, it's kind of a traditional superhero story. You know, at least this issue is. And as things evolve, I mean, his artistry just, not that he wasn't great to start with, but it just becomes so amazing. He becomes Adam Hughes. You know,
he does.
While he's on this book.
And I think it happens really quickly. I think the Cooey 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 story is some of his finest work. Like, he really embraced it. And maybe you can see in these first couple of issues of his that he was playing a little bit more by the numbers. Maybe Giffen was giving him a little more guidance, but he hadn't done superhero stuff. You know, he was still doing and finishing up his run on the Maze Agency, which has nary a cape to be found.
Mm.
So this is really his first time doing superheroes, I think. I mean, I could be wrong, but he did not have a long career before this.
Now, I would say on this issue, I think Art Nichols did a very good job, but last issue, Joe Rubenstein inked him. And this, maybe this is sacrilege for you big Adam Hughes fans, but I felt like Joe Rubenstein was a better inker for him at that point.
Joe Rubenstein's a better inker for everybody. Come on.
You know. There's that. Yeah. There's that. But he also brought that sort of consistent JLI look because, you know, Joe was inking Kevin and then Joe was inking Ty.
Yeah.
And then, you know, with Joe doing it, it helped bring sort of, not a house style because it's not a house style, but I guess it made a little more consistent. So I don't know. And this will evolve as I don't really know because I haven't read much far ahead on purpose. So I don't know who becomes Adam's regular inker on the book. I know he worked with both these guys at different points.
I feel like it's Art Nichols. I feel like the two of them were kind of the duo. I mean, I could be wrong because I haven't read ahead either.
Well, yeah. It could be too that they're just learning each other's style at this point.
Certainly, yeah.
There's a lot of things already out of the gate that are fantastic. Like Teasdale, he looks freaking amazing. He has this really specific look. It's really, really well defined by Hughes. And like, you know, when you see it, like Maxwell Lord, for example, Maxwell Lord is just a dude in a suit with brown hair. That's all he is. But when McGuire draws him and then picked up later by Ty Templeton and by Adam Hughes and other artists, when you see that guy in a suit with brown hair and you can go, that's Maxwell Lord, that means that they defined that character very well.
Yeah.
Well, Teasdale is like that, except he's even cartoonish. So it goes a step further. So like, if I saw this mad scientist in a lineup of mad scientists, I would immediately be able to go, that's Teasdale. Because he's got such a unique look, which is just fantastic. And that's down to Hughes in this issue. It looks great.
Yeah, it's a fantastic look. I mean, he's like, you know, 5 foot nothing tall. And that mad scientist thing, you know, on page two, the last panel with this crazy underbite kind of grin. Beautiful. It's like, oh my God. Yeah, it's just glorious. And Adam Hughes taking the time to make those little touches, I think is what makes the difference.
It's a glorious, that panel especially is just absolutely glorious. Absolutely love it. Other fun stuff in here that they continue the bit where Batman wears the NATO suit and his ear points bend inside the helmet.
Yes.
Always cracks me up. They could do a whole book of that and I would just laugh my butt off like a 16-year-old, I guess.
Exactly.
And by the way, this is my patented, non-sponsored, but I should be getting money for this point where I plug the digital versions of these books, and the recoloring is astonishingly gorgeous and vibrant and pop, so seek it out on Comixology or DC Universe, whichever. I don't care. But read it digitally, folks. It is beautiful. And read it in panel mode so you can suck in every line that Hughes put into the work because it's just gorgeous.
Mm. So. Maybe that's part of my sadness then. Maybe that's why this book is not hitting me on all the feels, is because, of course, back in the day when you got them, they were all crisp and white and wonderful. Yep. And now I took it out of the bag and I was like, well, it looks old.
Yep, it does.
It does, yeah.
Paper has not aged well. It's really absorbed a lot of the ink.
Yep.
The blacks are flat. Like when you see, especially like heavy blacks, like there's a panel I'm going to talk about right now. On page 8, there's this, in bottom left-hand corner, there's this amazing shot of Batman, which in the page here on the actual printing comic, it looks okay. But the digital version, it looks awesome because the blacks are so deep and it looks like he's trying to draw Batman from the 1989 movie, actually. And he's doing it very, very well. It looks like, you know, maybe not Michael Keaton's jaw specifically, but the cowl looks like the 89 Batman cowl and it looks fantastic.
It does. Yeah, it does. And you know, that's one of the things I love about the omnibuses, and thank God they're back on schedule. Despite the dropped panels and the weird editorial production end of the volume one omnibus, it's never looked better. Oh my gosh, you know, compared to looking at the newsprint, I love seeing it in this restored way.
Oh, it's stunning. Absolutely stunning. In fact, folks, I didn't know this, but the if you don't want to shell out the money for the omnibus, Comixology actually has the digital one out there of the omnibus, I think for $30, which is
wow.
Heck of a deal. And you get 1,000 pages of comics. It's not bad.
Seriously. Yeah.
Since we were on the art stuff, I'm going to keep rolling on that before I go back to the story. But like another Adam Hughes thing I love that he did was Metamorpho. He does this bit where Metamorpho turns his legs into a unicycle wheel
yes.
and his hand into a megaphone. And all I could think was, oh my gosh, that feels like such a callback to like Ramona Freyden era of Metamorpho. Because that doesn't look like the Metamorpho we've seen anywhere else except for that kind of era. And that made me so happy to see. And maybe it's just me, but that's the era. That didn't look like Metamorpho from The Outsiders to me. That looked like Metamorpho from the Ramona Freyden stuff.
No, absolutely. And then the page that's on is an excellent page too, because we really get to see Rocket Red and Fire and Power Girl and Metamorpho all really being perfect to their characters. Like, this is on point for all of these characters, and it's really well done. The layout is great. The dialogue is great. That is one of the better pages too.
I didn't think about that. That really is an exemplary page. You're right, because Fire is, you know, reveling her powers. Power Girl is absolutely being the heavy gun she is. She's taking out the heavy weaponry, which is what she should be doing, because that's how strong she's equivalent to Superman at this point. So that makes a lot of sense. I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, and a lot of things get conveyed in this one page that really moves the characters along and the story, which is an art form unto itself.
All right, so the last thing I want to talk about art-wise, then we'll get into some more story stuff. The last page, it's a fun page because you get a lot of the kind of stuff. But the zombie-like people. One is this woman. She's this European woman. She's got the stereotypical St. Pauli's girl outfit on. She's got the Princess Leia-style hair buns, but they're blonde. She's slavering at the mouth. But the part that just puts me into hysterical giggles is she's wearing floral print oven mitts. Like, she was home taking, something out of the oven when the gas hit, and now she's a monster, but she's still wearing the oven mitts, which just cracks me.
That's perfect. And you know, it makes me wonder, this would be a good question to ask these guys. So who comes up with that? Is that Hughes on his own, or is that something that either Giffen or DeMatteis say, hey, put this in there?
That's a good question. I would suspect it's probably Hughes. Based on everything I've heard DeMatteis and Giffen talk about the way this book was produced, you know, Giffen would draw a little mini comic for the plot. DeMatteis would then do the script and the word balloons, but I've always got the impression that a lot of the art there was a lot of freedom from the artist to throw stuff in the background.
Oh, absolutely.
So that's what I was thinking.
Yeah.
All right, talking about some story notes, I love in the early on when Teasdale shoots the canister in and he says Geronimo. I didn't notice, because he says, as we used to say when we were kids, Geronimo. And I started thinking, I guess that phrase did sort of fall out of favor, you know, as being perhaps...
Sure.
Yeah. Insensitive or whatever, but all thanks to Matt Smith and Doctor Who for bringing that phrase back into modern day. So I'm thrilled about that.
That's true.
So we also get in this issue something that explains last month's cover. Last month's Justice League Europe cover specifically. There are zombie United Nations soldiers in here firing machine guns at Guy and Ice, because I guess they've just been hit by the gas and they're not zombie enough yet to lose their minds, so they're firing their guns. And that sort of explains last month's Justice League Europe cover, because we were sitting here debating. We're going, okay, wait a minute. There's zombies or vampires, whatever, but they're carrying guns? I don't get it. So I guess maybe this was tied into that, perhaps. I don't know.
Yeah. And that was one of my things when I started rereading it, too. I was like, can they just not settle on vampires or zombies? Because it started out in one place, and then it became very interchangeable. And then, like in this issue, I think they don't even mention either. It's just sort of like, it's implied. They are what they are.
Yeah. Two other things here. Just I think there's a map in here, which actually confirms that this story is taking place in modern-day Kosovo, by the way, near Serbia. Interesting. But I think one of my favorite pages, you love the blue period page.
Yes.
I love page 8, the top part, which is the Justice League Europe and Justice League America together. And they're having a discussion. Well, it's a great group shot, basically. It's one of those, you love to see the teams together and everyone's off in their own corners having their own sort of interactions, like a cover to a Who's Who or something.
Yes. I wish it were bigger. That would be a great two-page splash nowadays, right?
Or perhaps you could read it digitally and it could be as big as your computer screen.
There we go.
Just saying.
Go digital.
Yes. But you get Ralph, he's cracking a joke, which is great, and Blue Beetle saying, oh, God, Dibny, is that all you can do is joke? Which is, you know, hilarious that it's coming out of Blue Beetle's mouth.
Yes.
You get Flash hitting on Ice. I mean, really pushing it, and Ice rebuking him. And then 11 pages later, she's even got her hand up, like in a background shot. It's not even verbalized, where she's basically pushing the Flash away, which is hilarious. Guy Gardner's planning to abandon the commies to their fate, which is very in character. And then there's this wonderful little shot of Fire and Rocket Red. They're not even talking. There's nothing happening there. But she is sitting on a rock. She's taking her boot off. She's shaking it out and shaking the rock rocks out of her boot. And you know that they're having some sort of nice conversation because they used to be teammates and now they don't see each other as often. And it's like a nice moment. I like it a lot.
Yeah, and it's a nice sort of continuation of that page that we were throwing so much praise on, you know, 2 pages ago, where the two of them are clearly teamed up and working together. And he's kind of playing, you know, devil's advocate a little bit to her newfound power and her tendencies. So I see that moment as a continuation of that conversation.
I didn't even think of that synchronicity, but it makes sense that Hughes is doing that because, again, he has Flash and Ice here, and he synchronizes them 11 pages later in a similar setup. So he's really thinking this through, which is great.
Very nice. Yeah.
And I think that's probably my favorite part of this particular issue is the Justice League America and Justice League Europe sort of connections and interactions. I think that's really my favorite moments of the story because not a lot happens as far as this moving the story forward. You know, the zombie thing. We do find out the history of what's caused the plague.
Yes.
And we find out where it's going. Is that that's why they're going? They're going after the big canister. But the reality is, it's a bit like Doctor Who, classic Doctor Who. It's my second Doctor Who reference. Sorry. where episode 3 is a lot of running down corridor. Usually,
it's right.
1 and 2 sets it up. 4 ends it. 3's not killing time necessarily, but not necessarily doing a lot either. And that's kind of what this one feels like. Not in a bad way, because it's gorgeous and a lot of character interaction, but not a lot of story movement.
Yeah, and to your point too, I think it really is interesting. Adam Hughes is doing a great job of managing all of these characters and creating subtle through lines, even if they're not talking, which is no easy task. This is 2 entire teams put together in one book with a horde of zombies.
Right.
So that's a lot of stuff to really manage and maintain, and he does a great job of keeping it so that if you only started at the beginning and followed Fire, you would see a whole story for her throughout the book. Same with every character. I just have a feeling that if you did that, you would see that.
That's a good point. And, you know, thinking about what a young artist he was at this point, too, and just learning the craft as he goes. I mean, there's a lot of on-the-job learning at this point for him because he'd only been in the industry for 2 years with no professional training. Yeah, you can. It's amazing that he would think it through that deeply.
Yeah, he's going places, that kid.
He might. He might. So, I'm sorry, I got to mention one more panel just because it's on the same page.
Yes.
It's that same page with the Justice League meeting on page 8 at the bottom where Blue Beetle is looking up, but he's squinting. And it's just like, that is such a perfectly laid out face of Beetle guy. He's got his hand to his forehead, like blocking the sun. His eyes are squinting. His whole jaw is like tightened up. I mean, you know exactly what he's doing. And that's always been a hallmark of this particular book is find an artist that can do an amazing facial expression.
That's it. Oh, absolutely.
And that's all there. So, fun issue. Now, I got to say one quick thing about the letters page at the back. There is a mention of Scott Tipton. He had written a letter, and you may know Scott. He is a modern-day comics professional and a past guest of this very show.
Hey.
In his letter, Scott was praising Aquaman. It's almost like Scott knew that in 30 years' time, he'd be appearing as a guest on the Fire & Water Podcast Network. So, way to go, Scott. All right, so without really sharing any specific spoilers, because we still got one more issue to cover, what are your thoughts on the Teasdale Imperative crossover as a whole?
You know, it's like I said kind of earlier, there's a lot of great nostalgia in it for me, reading it and seeing it after all this time. I find myself much more compelled by the Adam Hughes-drawn issues, not so much for the Bart Sears stuff. I was never a huge, huge fan of his. I do think this is some of his better work of the era, but it is a little bit jarring going between issues and switching the art styles so drastically, I think. But, I mean, overall, this is, I think, a decent crossover for both teams because it gives you a sense of they are part of the same umbrella team, if you will. They are one big team. They're just in 2 different locations. And I think the character interactions and just the way the relationships sort of continue to evolve separate from each other, but also come together and have whole new relationship dynamics. I mean, that's the best part of this for me, I think. The Teasdale thing and the zombies and all of that stuff, really, it's kind of just that's the crisis that's put into place for them to get together and have these character moments. I don't know. As a true crisis, Teasdale, not really a super villain, you know?
Yeah.
Not really dark side level. But hey, he brought them together for a pretty fun little romp. So I'm going to thank him for that.
That sort of fits with what I always think about with Justice League International. That era is a lot of the best stories come from what happens in between the big adventures, what happens between the characters. And that's what you just said, basically, is the high point of this for you was the characters and the way they interacted with each other. So that makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely.
All right, folks. Well, I think that's going to wrap up the issue. Now it is time for... Wahaha Award. This is where we are going to nominate the funniest moment in the issue. Both myself and Jeff are going to pick a moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Bwahaha Award. Now, since you badmouthed so much of the humor already in this issue, Jeff, thank you very much. I'm writing a note to JMD Mateus about that, by the way.
Oh, no.
What is your pick for this issue?
Well, I'm going to say the true comedy in this issue that works for me is Teasdale. The stuff that he's doing, it's very kind of meta, a wannabe supervillain kind of chit-chat. And then he has the encounter with the gray man who kind of has to admonish him and send him scurrying down the hillside to go be a proper villain. And he's just not built for it. So he's kind of a comedic villain, if you will, a very Don Knotts-ian sort of sort of character. And I think my favorite joke of the whole thing is on page two, right out of the gate, you know, just him talking to himself and being self-aware of it. And even saying that he's starting to laugh like a comic book villain with the nyahahaha kind of moment that he starts and then he stops himself and is like, oh, no, I can't. I would sound like a comic book villain if I did that. And so to me, that's my pick. I like that self-aware doofus villain.
That is very, very insightful. That was on my list of very possible picks. So we'll have to see. Mine is on the very next page, actually. Well, it's a combination of things. It starts on the next page when Captain Atom and Power Girl are flying and the canister flies right between them. And they both look at it and they're like, huh? And then that's actually not my favorite bit. That's tied to that, though, is on the next page after that when they're talking about that incident. And he's talking to her, and obviously we come in midway through an argument and he says to her, how'd you miss that? And she's like, you were standing right there. Why didn't you grab it? He's like, well, I thought you were going to do it. Let's just get down there. Which I enjoyed that bit. And I felt like that was one of the jokes that didn't feel like it was shoved in because I felt like it was there in the art. It was part of the storytelling. Whereas, again, like the elongated man joke could have been removed and you wouldn't know because it's not in the art, whereas this one was in the art. And as I'm sitting here verbalizing it, I'm hating myself because I'm talking myself out of my pick.
Oh no. Because you were talking me into it. Hang on.
Okay.
Because I do. I support your theory here. This is genuine dialogue between genuine characters that is funny, but it also plays in the situation that they're in. So the comedy is just sort of incidental comedy. And I think that's the best kind sometimes. It's not forced. It's there and it's natural and it's believable. And I think it works really, really well.
And one of the things I like about it too is these are Titanic level characters. These aren't, you know, Robin or Blue Beetle, you know, powerless folks. These people are massively powerful.
Right.
And yet they're sitting here pointing fingers to each other going, well, why didn't you stop it? I just found that very, very funny.
No, I agree with you. I don't know. Huh?
The Teasdale one I could go with because the humor is throughout it. I genuinely laughed out loud when he said, right after the bit where you said about comic book villain, where he goes, after this mess is over, I'm definitely taking a vacation. I just found that so funny and sort of, again, workplace comedy. That's what this book is a lot of times. So now we got to decide, Jeff.
Oh, man.
I don't know. You're the guest. I'll let you either make your defense or crumble first, whichever.
Oh, man. You know, we're so conciliatory here. I don't know what to do. I'm gonna give it to you because as a playwright, as a writer myself, the stuff that you chose as the Bwahaha moment is the kind of stuff that I would think on a good day I would write.
So. Well, normally I would be nice and go, oh, well, Jeff, you were so nice. But you know what? I kind of like winning. And you are an accomplished and published writer, so I got to trust your judgment in the category of writing. So, yes, we're going to give it to Captain Atom and Power Girl. Congratulations to these amazingly powerful yet completely incapable superheroes. You have won the Bwahaha Award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as the laughter we give you. Now, Jeff, I need to ask a favor. If
sure.
You don't mind.
Yeah, go for it.
I need to go take care of something. Would you mind hanging around the embassy here? I just bought, they came in on Amazon. I just bought some new lamps and they're UV lamps and daylight bulbs, stuff like that. I just thought maybe that'd help keep the zombie vampire creatures away during the day.
A good plan.
Would you mind installing all this?
Sure. How many people do I have to help me screw in all the light bulbs though?
You're the writer. You figure out how to finish that joke.
Oh, God. Where's Beetle and Booster? Hang on. I got to go find those guys. I'll be right back.
Perfect. Great. Well, don't worry, folks. Jeff will be back at the end of the show. And after this podcast promo break, I'm going to head over to the Paris Embassy for the 8th issue of Justice League Europe and the conclusion of the Teasdale Imperative.
I hope he's home.
Thank you.
Why does it sound like I'm using a phone in the UK?
I told you never to call me again.
Yeah, I know. And modern science has yet to create a device to measure how much I don't care. Look, I'm getting the trailer for this year's JL May together, and I assumed I had to make you a part of it since you're always in everybody's trailer or something.
Well, look at you, leading this year's JL May. Somebody's wearing his big boy pants. So, what's the theme?
I sent you an email like a month ago.
Like I even pay attention to anything you send me.
Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
Infinite Crisis?
No, Countdown to Infinite Crisis.
I'm not following.
Shocking. The theme this year, I'm talking to a child. The theme this year is Countdown to Infinite Crisis. I thought it was a fascinating time period in DC's history. So a bunch of us are getting together to talk about the various specials and miniseries and crossovers that led up to Infinite Crisis. It's the event before the event. The whole thing is going to kick off on April 30th, 2020 with a special episode of Views from the Long Box covering the Countdown to Infinite Crisis 80-page giant, and from there, a whole bunch of shows that I will be adding in post-production will discuss these previously mentioned miniseries and crossover issues.
And people actually agreed to this?
Shockingly, yes!
Well, it's probably a good thing that you're going to cover Countdown to Infinite Crisis instead of the Countdown series, because that was a train wreck.
Yeah, you know, actually, that was my thinking, too. Now, are you going to help me with this trailer or not?
Fine, I will help you with your little trailer.
Good. Don't worry, by the way. There won't be any dates for you to get wrong.
I hate you so much.
JL May 2020. Countdown to Infinite Crisis. The event before the event. This crossover kicks off on April 30th, 2020, on Views from the Long Box, and continues into Aquaman and Firestorm, the Fire and Water podcast, Robin, Everyone Loves the Drake, Pop Culture Affidavit, It All Comes Back to Superman, The Fan Holes Podcast, Justice's First Dawn, The Birds of Prey Podcast, Married with Comics, The Coffee and Comics Podcast, The Long Box Crusade, Task Force X, Relatively Geeky Presents, Wonder Woman, Warrior for Peace, and the Dr. DC Podcast.
Hi, I'm Ruth.
And I'm Darren of the Rad Adventures Network.
We're a married couple who enjoy great stories of all kinds, including adventures, mysteries, science fiction, and fantasy.
Please join us for a variety of podcasts focused on a range of pop culture topics.
Trekker Talk is about 23rd century bounty hunter Mercy St. Clair from the comic Trekker by writer and artist Ron Randall. It's a blend of classic sci-fi adventures and noir mysteries set in a retro future.
Xenozoic Xenophiles is about the comic Xenozoic Tales by writer and artist Mark Schultz. It's a post-apocalyptic adventure series filled with Cadillacs and dinosaurs.
Warlord Worlds covers the many comics of writer and artist Mike Grell, including The Warlord, John Sable, Green Arrow, and the Legion of Superheroes.
Sensational Sleuths, where we talk about favorite mystery novels, movies, and TV shows.
Fantastic Fantasies, where we share our favorite fantasy films and books.
And Amazing Adventures, where we discuss action-packed adventure stories.
Listen on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and YouTube. And follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram.
Or visit radadventuresnetwork.com to find all of our shows and links to our social media pages.
That's RAD, R-A-D, which is short for Ruth and Darren.
And now, our coverage of Justice League Europe, number 8. from break, and I'm here with our second co-host for this episode. I gotta tell you, folks, I am really, really excited about this. This is cool. It's a pretty special honor. Well, when I corresponded with this guy about recording this episode together, he informed me, and I quote, he said, "I've never done a podcast, and honestly, I'm scared that I wouldn't do a good job on your show, but I just can't shake this thought, so I just have to ask." Wow! Seriously, he wrote that to me. I am so flattered that he wants this episode to be his podcasting debut. So, I am thrilled to help a new voice find its way into the podcasting verse. Folks, please help me welcome to the show for their very first podcast appearance anywhere, Mr. Tim Price. Welcome to the Paris Embassy, Tim. Thanks for being here. How you doing? And welcome to podcasting.
Yeah, wow. Thanks, Shag. I guess you don't check your inbox very often?
What are you talking about? I got the email right here.
Well, I sent that email 3 years ago.
Yeah.
And since that time, a lot has happened in that time. I've hung out with you at Comic-Cons twice.
I have no memory of this.
Well, plus I've appeared on 35 podcasts, including this one last year. Yeah, maybe that should kind of ring a bell. And also, there's another detail you didn't mention about that email. In the reply you wrote back to me,
yeah,
you said you thought you had already asked me to be on the show.
Okay, no. All right. So,
I'm starting to suspect. You know, have you been checked out lately? You had trouble last month remembering that you'd recorded with Jose Rivera.
But that was 10 years ago, dude.
I'm just saying. Just be good to yourself. That's all I'm going to say. Be good to yourself, okay?
Okay, no, wait. Back up some facts here. Yes, it has been 3 years since you wrote me that email. That is true. When you wrote that email, it was true. You had never done a podcast before, right?
This is true.
Okay. And
then
we scheduled you for Justice League Europe number 8 at that time, 3 years ago, correct?
Yes. I'm not disputing those facts.
At that time, this was the very first podcast for Justice League Europe number 8 you were ever booked for.
Yes.
So this is your first podcast appearance ever.
I don't think that's how the math works. I think if you go to my Podcast DB page, you'll see that my first appearance is from not too long after in that same year.
I am accepting credit for bringing you into the podcast first, whether you like it or not, sir. And I don't think you understand the way logic works. I realize you program computers for a living, but that's just magic and nonsense anyway.
Well, I suppose someone who's into marketing would know more about logic than I would. I guess that's probably true.
Thank you. Someone who finally gets it. I appreciate it.
Yeah.
Well, Tim, it is nice to, all honesty, to have you back. Yes, folks, Tim was on, what did you say, was he about a year ago? I guess, yeah. Talking with us about Mr. Miracle. We talked about the Mr. Miracle spinoff. We had a great time. That was super fun. In fact, go back to that episode, folks. It was a double feature episode where we talked about Dr. Fate and Mr. Miracle. And there you can hear Tim, who's already answered the questions we normally ask our guests about what was your JLI origin. The episode came out in February 2019, so be sure to check that out. But today, we are going to talk about, again, the first comic Tim was ever scheduled to talk about, Justice League Europe number 8. Very excited about this. It's from DC Comics, cover dated November 1989. It was on the shelves October 3rd, 1989. Cover price $1 for shiny quarters. The cover is by Bart Sears and Art Nichols, and it is a heck of a cover. Why don't you tell us about it, Tim?
Oh, I love this cover so much.
Me too!
It's so good. And it's been worth waiting the 3 years to talk about it. I gotta say, it's definitely a cover that holds up over the 3 years. What we got here, we have the big Justice League Europe logo in the front and the title, The Teasdale Imperative Part 4, guest starring Justice League America. And we see the assembled JLI walking away from the reader in a destroyed European village with the mountains in the distance. And some of the mountains are covered by this enormous shadow, and we see Blue Beetle turn behind himself and says, uh-oh, in one of those beautiful word balloons. And this is just a gorgeous cover. We see almost all the JLI on this cover, and it doesn't feel cramped, but it's just gorgeous. We have the clouds in the background above the mountains, and there's a fire that's kind of, the smoke is blooming up, and behind the Justice League Europe logo and everything. This is just a powerful cover. What do you think of it?
Oh, dude, I absolutely love this cover. In fact, it's so good. good. They used this same cover on the trade paperback, Justice League International Volume 6, which collects...
Wow.
So it's actually,
I did not know that.
It's on the cover there entirely. You did too. If you scroll down, I put a picture of it in here. Don't pretend.
What?
Anyway.
What? What are you talking about? Scroll down what? I'm just making this all up as I go along. What are you talking about?
We'll get to the specifics of that in a minute. But yeah, they reuse the cover because it's just that good. So a couple different things I love about this. So it really gives you the sense of a Pyrrhic victory. I mean, you look at the body language of like Captain Atom. He's walking, mm-hmm. but his head's down. His shoulders aren't quite slumped, but they look like they're almost rolled forward. Ice. You look at Ice. She's holding herself and her head's down. She's upset. Look, even Guy Gardner's got his head down. Everyone looks depressed. And as you mentioned the fires. I think you mentioned the bodies that are all around them as well. It looks like they've won at a terrible cost. So that part of it is super powerful. You're right. It doesn't feel crowded. You get all these jail ires, both of America and Europe on there. It's fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
The bit with Blue Beetle's hilarious. Because, yeah, he's the only one who noticed there's apparently a Godzilla-sized monster behind them or something coming at them with the shadows. I love that.
If you look at the Flash right next to him, he's the only one who is looking even slightly up. So you do suspect that maybe Wally has noticed the shadow.
Oh,
also.
Yeah. It looks like Wally, you're right. Wally's seen the shadows and Blue Beetle's the one who's turning around. Yeah, good point.
Mm-hmm. Oh, that's really nice.
Now, interesting, there are some coloring mistakes on here, right?
Yeah, there sure are. It's on my hard copy of it, especially, I can see like that Captain Atom's boots are silver on the printed one. And also, it's very subtle, but the goggles on Blue Beetle are red, which is like, how'd that slip through? That's a very small detail, but it's like, it's just weird.
Yeah, it gives Blue Beetle an entirely different look when you make his lenses red. It looks, mm-hmm. reminds me of the Super Friends, when they did that episode where they go to the parallel world where everyone's evil and Superman's eyes are red. That's kind of what it reminds me of.
Oh. Oh, yeah. But also then on the, well, now, seriously, folks, I did not know about the collected edition using this cover. So I hadn't seen this cover before today. And it's just gorgeous because what they've done is redoing the coloring on it. They've added more textures and green to the mountains instead of it being kind of like neutral tan shading.
Yeah.
And the shadow of the villain is also much less distinct.
Oh, yeah.
On this version.
It's almost impossible to see, even. You can really, the hand is really the only part that really jumps out.
Yeah, I do wish it was a little bit more distinct, but I like it being not as stark of a shadow as you see in the original version, because I think it makes it a little bit easier to believe why the JLI hasn't quite noticed yet.
And I think part of the reason for that, too, is being on the cover of a trade paperback, they're trying to draw the reader's focus towards the Leaguers, because the mm-hmm. crisis they're facing isn't as important as the Leaguers themselves when you're trying to sell a trade paperback to somebody. The crisis part of it fits with the issue itself, but if you want to buy the whole trade, mm-hmm. you want to look at the League. Now, the coloring, we should talk about this for a little bit further. Okay, so there's a lot of coloring options for you with this cover. There's the original printed one, which Tim just mentioned, that's got the mistake on Captain Adam's boots, and it's got the mistake on Blue Beetle's goggles. That same mistakes appear in the digital version of this single issue. Like if you're looking on DC Universe app and you mm-hmm. look at this issue, you will see those same coloring mistakes. Then if you pick up the collected edition, which is in volume 6, as you flip through there and you get to the cover for on that section of the book, you will see they have corrected all the coloring mistakes. You'll see Blue Beetle's lenses are yellow, Captain Atom's boots are blue. So all those minor mm-hmm. mistakes have been fixed. Then, as you brought us to, the cover for the trade paperback is entirely recolored. It's got all the modern day shading and gray radiance and things like that. I mean, so mm-hmm. You know me. You know how I operate, right? The male gaze is like the way I live. So, and the very center focus of the team is Fire's butt. I mean, tell me I'm wrong.
You are not wrong, but they're also, not to say butt, but however, there are butt shots galore in this cover because it has the whole team walking away.
Yeah, that's
so,
true.
You know, but you can't miss Fires because she's dead center.
She's dead center. She's got her hips cocked, the whole thing.
Yeah. And but right next to her and closer to the reader is Captain Atom in all his shiny glory.
That's true.
And Dimitri is certainly rocking it right next to him.
He's cocking the hip too. Good point. Yep.
He's got it going. You know, what do you think? Was this Bart's? I think Bart Sears this is his. I think this is, I don't think this is a Keith Giffen layout of a cover. Honestly,
probably
I don't think so.
It is probably Bart Sears. But yeah, Giffen is, his hallmark is the love of butt shots. Part of the reason I bring up the fire one too, though, is in the recoloring, they've added all the shading gradients. I mean, it just makes her mm-hmm. butt that more, look at me, look at me, look at me. In fact, until this moment, because I was staring at her butt, I didn't notice that they miscolored her boots. Interesting,
yeah,
on the collected edition has a mistake. Her boots are white instead of green.
Well, and to keep that theme, if you look at Dimitri, Rocket Red, mm-hmm. his shorts are silver instead of red.
Oh, yeah. that.
As well.
I was checking out his butt. You think I would have noticed that? Huh.
It's great that we have these two covers right by side here because it's like, one of these things is not like the other.
It is like that
and
game.
Just like, six things are different between these two covers.
Well, looking at them side by side, I do like, we talked about the shadow sort of fades away, but it really does make it feel like the Justice Leaguers pop off the page a lot more. Like on the printed original cover, they don't disappear, but the Captain Atom kind of does. I mean, he doesn't pop off the page. Whereas in the recolored for the trade paperback, I mean, he just pops right off the page because the blue in contrast to the greens, it looks great. So my preference, if I had to pick, is the trade paperback recoloring. I think it's beautiful.
I don't know if I would want to pick because I'm a good parent and I love all my children just in different ways.
Oh,
so it's hard to, but I love the modern shading and the gradients that they have on the trade paperback. That's really gorgeous. But it's like, I still got plenty of love for the original. It's funny to me when I look at my original, it's like, I can just tell that either it's faded a little bit or even for the digital versions, they lightened it up.
Yeah.
Because like the logo for Justice League is purple on my print version, whereas it's a deep blue in the digital single issue version.
Yeah. And Blue Beetle on my printed version, the blue, the darker blue on his body is super dark. And so is Batman's cape, whereas the digital version of that issue, it's a lot lighter.
And I think that that's also what makes it Captain Atom still, he's still silver and shiny. So he does jump out more on the original printed version. Whereas when they lightened the colors of everything, now that's what makes him faded in the digital single issue version.
Could be.
I don't know what they originally intended. I don't know what they originally intended by this point.
I know we're boring the heck out of you guys at home. I'm sorry. I will try include some of the different versions. Well, probably.
Wake up.
Spent like 20 minutes talking about the color of somebody's boots.
At least we stopped talking about butts. Come on.
The fire's butt conversation probably, you know, cheered him up.
Yeah.
But so I'll try to include some of these covers versions on the gallery so you'll be able to see them sort of side by side to see what that is. So, but we should get into it. So let's do this. So folks, once you get inside, the plot and breakdowns are by Keith Giffen. Script is by JMD Mateus. Brace yourself, folks. If you're not aware, this is the last regular issue of Justice League Europe with JMD Mateus as scripter. I know. Everyone.
No!
I know. Take a breath. More on that later. Penciler is Bart Sears. Inker is Bob Smith, who I believe is new for us in Justice League Europe. Letter is Bob LePan. Colorist is Gene D'Angelo. Assistant editor Kevin Dooley and editor Andy Helfer. The issue itself, it's Teasdale Imperative Part 4, but the issue itself is called Showdown. Tim, why don't you start us off on the recap?
So we start right away with Dr. Fate, who's been cast back to Earth after failing to get the Lords of Order to help stop the Gray Man, whose vampire horde controlled by him and Teasdale surrounds Simon Stagg's factory and the JLI. While the JLI discuss, argue, and make jokes, discuss their next move, Graysdale walk through the electric fence.
Is that the shipping name?
Yes, it is. Thank you for that. Graysdale walk through the electric fence to steal enough vampire revamping vats to infect everyone on Earth. But first, they call the Horde to charge. Dr. Fate tries to intervene to no avail, so the vampires die en masse on the electric fence, powering up Gray Man to gargantuan heights for a rampage, and there's no Rock Johnson to stop him. The JLI dodge debris.
God, this is so corny. Folks, if you could see this at home, his write-up, he has taken as many words as possible and replaced them with the word gray. It is redunculous.
Hey, you knew what you were getting into when you signed up for the show. Come on.
No, I didn't. When I invited you for the show, you'd never done a podcast before.
Oh, that's right. Sucks to be you. All right.
This is what I get for signing a newbie to podcasting. Oh, my gosh.
Where was I? Oh, yeah. Here we go. The JLI dodge debris while the most powerful attack, but can't stop him from giving Power Girl one punch. I mean, a magic boosted slap. And she disappears over the horizon.
Okay, that's enough. Thank you. I will take it from here. Captain Atom and Elongated Man hold back the enormous Gray Man just long enough so that Martian Manhunter and Rocket Red can get away with the vats of vampire zombie serum. Dr. Fate then faces off against the Gray Man, and our heroic magical lady does some pretty serious damage. Then Simon Stagg and Java try to sneak away, but they run into Erwin Teasdale, who is excited because he wants to watch them die. But at the last moment, the Gray Man stomps on Teasdale for failing him, reducing Teasdale to a sticky red smear on the bottom of his shoes. Stagg and Java manage to get away. Now, it looks like the Gray Man is going to be unstoppable, but then the Spectre shows up with the Lords of Order and the Lords of Chaos in tow. The Lords of Order are unhappy that the Gray Man has stolen their soul stuff, and the Lords of Chaos feel like the Gray Man has threatened them. Their punishment is to drain his power and leave him an empty mental husk with no independent thought or willpower. A lot like Tim.
Oh, yay! Hey, thanks.
The Martian Manhunter then thinks about recruiting the Spectre, that it might be a good idea. And the team realizes that Power Girl never came back after being slapped by the Gray Man. Much later, back at the Justice League Europe embassy, we join Captain Atom and Catherine Colbert discussing Power Girl, who has ended up in the hospital. Catherine helps pull the captain out of his self-pity and manages to flirt with him at the same time. Finally, the Flash pays a visit to Power Girl in the hospital ICU. Flash apologizes for the way he's treated her in a very touching scene, and he promises to be better and asks her in return, quote, just don't die. So, next issue, as Power Girl's life hangs by a thread, the Flash and the Elongated Man finally have it out. All this plus new Justice League Europe scripter, William Messner Loebs. Say goodnight, JM.
Goodnight, JM.
That is issue number 8 of Justice League Europe. What'd you think, buddy?
Oh, this issue is so good.
It is.
It had so much action in it. It was retaining the heart of what JLE started with in its first 4 issues. It was getting right back to that sort of thing, which also is just to the first, 7 issues of Justice League. Just before it became Justice League International.
Sure.
It's got a big threat that we need the combined team to take care of. And we got the biggest gut punch moment we've seen so far in either series, in my opinion, to date.
Wow. You talking about Power Girl?
Yes, what Power Girl's right there. So,
and you think that surpasses the Blue Beetle brainwashing?
I do.
Wow, okay.
Just barely.
I'm not arguing with you. I'm just asking you for clarification, because the people at home feel pretty strongly about the Blue Beetle brainwashing, so that's a lot.
I felt extremely strong about the Blue Beetle moment. But the thing here is that it puts that cliche on its head of, the big fight, one of the people gets knocked out of the story, usually just for convenience sake, so they can't, save the day.
Right.
And it's like, they'll be okay. And when you go back and check on them later, of course they're okay. But not this time.
Yeah.
And that was just, when we see her in the hospital at the last page and Wally's moments with her there, that was one of the most touching scenes I think I've seen them write to date.
I gotta say, it is very powerful. It's very moving. It's very sad. Also, this is kind of weird to say, but I'm kind of glad this happened. That doesn't sound right, but it is good.
No, that doesn't sound right at all. What are you doing?
Well, it's good to show that there's consequences of this level of violence, or as Professor Allen might say, there's consequences of consequences. But the fact that Power Girl got hurt in battle, I mean, think about it. These people are punching and slapping and blasting each other all the time. Someone's going to get hurt. Here we see that. So now I realize part of it's plot driven, so that later on they can depower Power Girl, because right now she's basically Superman level. So you get the plot driven issue of bringing your power level down, but also it makes you feel something like, oh my gosh, this is dangerous. It's not just let's go out, have fun, crack some jokes, and fight somebody. It's we could die. So I think it provides a great story hook. It makes us care more about Power Girl. It also shows the consequences of their actions, so I think it's good. Now, we should mention, they also acknowledge in the issue that the slap that the Gray Man gave her, that, she should be able to take that punch without a problem. They say that it's actually the magic that was behind the slap that did the damage, which is sort of a nod to her Kryptonian heritage, which doesn't really exist anymore, or her Atlantean heritage, which is in effect at this point. So that's how you would put those two together.
Oh, yeah. It was definitely the magic part of sight. We've got that right away, because you could see, his hand glowing.
Yeah.
When it happens.
Yep.
So there's lots of big mega magic involved in that power, in that moment. And I will admit that also there's I don't want to talk about next issue, really, but next issue is also so good in terms of dealing with our characters here that the setup here is part of that whole journey, that whole story. Just like if you're taking one story of Blue Beetle's brainwashing and just trying to make that one story, have to have all your emotions tied into that one thing. It's like, no, that's not how it happens. We have the whole arc. This one kind of starts here and finishes in the next issue. So taken together, it's a very emotional point in the series to date.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
So yeah, getting on to some of the artwork on this one, it's like, oh, Bart Sears is just on point on every page of this issue. I mean, he is channeling Sean McManus majorly for his depiction of Dr. Fate, and she looks just on point and exactly on model for how he depicted her in that series all the way.
It's astonishing. It really is. If you showed me that page out of context and maybe took the word balloons off it, I'd probably tell you it's a McManus page. I'd buy it.
Oh yeah, absolutely. Just as much facial expression on the mask that you see in McManus's work. So it's like, it's just fantastic.
I want to add, and this isn't about the art, but it's about that page. Just you really get it's a whole page of Dr. Fate is what it is, and sort of dealing with the fact that the Lords of Order cast her out and how she's going to deal with all this, you really get a sense for Linda in that page. You get a sense for her fear of being Dr. Fate on her own without Eric. It tells you a little bit about her history right there. It's a perfect sort of primer for the character. And I realize now that I started collecting the Dr. Fate book just a few months after this issue came out. And so this would have been my first real introduction to Linda as Dr. Fate.
Really?
And And I think, you know, I don't know whether this subconsciously made me more interested in buying the issue of Dr. Fate when I did, with it had the JLI in it. But I totally knew where I was going when I picked up the issue, though. It really does work very well. I also liked, now this is a little bit later, her inner monologue was funny. She would say really bold statements, you know, like, stop, in the, you know, Lords of Order, whatever. She was really bold, very heroic statements. And then immediately following, there'd be a word balloon of her going, did I really just say that? Or, you know, if you, you know, when she claims she's so powerful, she's like, yeah, if you believe that, I'll sell you the Brooklyn Bridge. I love the outward facing and the internal monologue. I thought that was really clever, because you don't really see that with the other Justice League members.
Oh, yeah. You can see her talk to herself on those things. This is also her showing the Giffen and DeMatteis, bringing out the fact that, yes, she's still a rookie.
Yeah, absolutely.
She does not really know how to deal with this on her own. But also, it's really funny to me that we have later in the same issue that, you know, Dr. Fate is saying, Naboo wants me in the League, and after today, I think I see his point. And then we never see her again in the series.
Right. So I hadn't checked ahead. You're always really good about bursting my balloon by telling me stuff ahead of the time.
I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. You just live under a little black rain cloud. But so, yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's well, we got Huntress last JLA, and then we got her here. I'm part of the team now. Poof, gone, you know, which is just hilarious.
Oh, yeah. Well, I think Huntress, you know, saw Batman was in the building and said, like, yeah, I gotta go.
Now, to be fair, the female Dr. Fate did last longer than Wonder Woman with the Justice League this in this era.
This is true. I'm not disagreeing with that at all. Yeah. She absolutely did. It's just funny. I don't know what happened. I don't really know if they really intended to have her in longer or not, because, you know, there's definitely a parallel here about Dr. Fate being here when fighting the Gray Man. So it's like, yeah, no more Gray Man. I guess, do we need Dr. Fate anymore?
No, I don't think that's what happened at all. If you look at the way the series went, the reason she's Dr. Fate is because Eric's very, very sick. Well,
oh, yes.
Eric's about to die, and then there is no Dr. Fate for a while. So I think that's what ends up happening, is that story is so involved in its own path right now, with Eric going away, she quitting Dr. Fate, then them both. Well, I don't want to spoil too much, but what happens to those two characters to the point where Dr. Fate's not even an active hero out there anymore. So I think that's really why she ends up out of the League, is simply because of what was going on in their own book.
I don't think we're spoiling it, because you already covered it in the episode you did last year.
Yeah.
So we're okay.
Mike and I kept backing off from certain spoilers because we love that series so much, we don't want to spoil it for people.
So it just comes into another case of a character who it's now history repeating itself. Exactly. Of a Dr. Fate being in the book, and it's like, nope, he's out of the book.
Yeah, Dr. Fate quits every time the Gray Man shows up. I got it.
Oh, well, getting back to the artwork, Guy's facial expressions in this issue are just fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he's just leering, and in that evil, giddy fashion he gets when it's a good fight about to start. It's just wonderful to see him being done by Bart Sears here.
He really has a handle on Guy. I mentioned it in the last episode when there was a panel where he was sneering and stuff like that. I mean, I don't know what it is. You look at the pictures of Guy Gardner, and while I know what he looks like in comic books, when I see the Bart Sears drawing, I can imagine what he looks like in real life. I'm like, okay.
Oh, yeah.
That's what he would look like in real life. I get it. You can almost see an actor playing him.
Mm-hmm. And then, the moment when the Gray Man pulls the Bambi versus Godzilla moment and squishes Teasdale. Oh, God. Oh. I think, I want to steal your word for it. You had written down gruesome. Yeah, but that's way too good a word for what happened there.
So, okay, here's the thing with that scene. I can't figure out that if it's super gross or my favorite scene in the whole book. I can't figure out which one, because it's amazing.
Oh.
I will say, too, from an artistic standpoint, you know me, I talk about this every month, guys, sorry, but I love reading these issues in panel-by-panel view digitally, and this one works super well in that way. Because when Teasdale gets squished, it's the last panel of the page. So if you start that page and look, and you might actually see Teasdale get squished before you get to that panel. When I was reading a panel by panel view, rereading it for the first time, you know, I didn't see ahead. So when he got squished, I had completely forgotten that. So I mean, it was a genuine whoa moment when I got to that panel.
I don't think I've ever heard you talk about panel by panel before, Shag. So glad that you finally thought to share that with the group.
Right. I'm just saying, folks. Panel by panel view helps keep the big surprises as big surprises.
I'm afraid that I've read this series too many times. It's like, I would remember it anyway. But
fair enough.
But no, I won't take that away from the fact that it's just a stunning moment on that page, no matter when you get there. And yeah, I love those sorts of moments being a surprise, whether it be by a page turn or like you're doing panel by panel there. It's almost a case there, I do think about when we see the bottom of the Gray Man's shoe in the following panel.
Yeah.
Like, that's where you kind of go like, oh, really? Oh. But it is kind of amping up the fact that this is kind of the horror moment of the book. This book has actually quite a bit of horror stuff happening in it.
It really does. Some of it's there, and then the more you think about it, the more horrific it gets. Like, I'll give you an example. The scene where the villagers who have been possessed all throw themselves against the electric fence to commit suicide, ends up powering the Gray Man. Like, on screen, it's like, oh, okay. But then as you really pay attention to it, they're like, they talk about the smell of the burning flesh, and the more you think about the fact that all these villagers were just innocent people who got gassed, became zombies, and now they are literally killing themselves to power the Gray Man. It is super horrific.
And if you go the next level, the fact that if you're thinking about the cleanup after the battle, that all those dead people are around this building's fence on all sides.
So gross. So
that's
gross.
Horrible. They're amping it up. They're definitely taking it up a notch. That's one thing about, you know, the scope of this particular story. You take it that way, and it's like all of a sudden it's a much bigger threat than it might have seemed otherwise.
You know, one of the things they don't address in the story too is even though they take the gas away from the Gray Man and they stop they don't stop Teasdale. The Gray Man stops Teasdale, but they save the world. But pretty much every villager and every United Nations soldier that got exposed to the gas, they're dead. Mm-hmm. None of them made it out of this thing. There was no cure. There was no reversal. None of it. They all died.
Yeah. Ooh. That gets right back to what you were saying about the cover, about it being something you can't pronounce.
First of all, the people at home victory. Don't know that. They don't know that it took me 7 tries to say Pyrrhic victory because I kept editing out.
Are you sure?
Yeah, I promise. I edited it out. Now they're hearing it because you're showing the cards. Thanks for that, buddy.
Oh, you'll just edit this out anyway. You'll fix it in post.
No, this is staying in.
But it was a huge Pyrrhic victory for our team here in that regard, because really, and so many of them wanted to save the innocent villagers and innocent people along the way. It's a heartbreaking moment.
Yeah.
Now let's get to the one part of the story that I get a chuckle out of. Mm-hmm. It's a sarcastic chuckle, not a wahaha chuckle. Is there's Batman grilling Simon Stagg, because Stagg has admitted that, oh no, they're here for the vats of formula. And Batman's like, vats? There's more of it in there? And you didn't tell us? And this is just one issue after Batman didn't tell his teammates that he had figured out a chemical agent had caused the plague in the first place.
Oh, good point.
And he's getting after Stagg about not telling that. It's like, Batman, yes, hello. What the heck?
Just remember, Batman is always a dick. That's pretty much how it works. Forgive the language.
We have the proof right here. I'm footnoting this for future reference.
Has there ever been a team that looked to themselves and went, you know, Batman's the heart and soul of this team? I don't think so.
Now, what about the gags about Gardner picking his nose?
Those were funny. They were also tied into a moment that I found interesting, where Ice was asking where Guy was. She actually cares for Guy. So I think this is one of the subtle ways they're trying to tell us that, yes, you know, that date was a freaking horror show, but Ice does actually like Guy.
Now, is this a bad relationship for Ice, or is this a good relationship for Guy?
It's both.
There's that.
It's a win for him, and boy, she could do better.
When you asked me who were my favorite JLI members back way, you know, 3 years ago, because it was 3 years ago. If you remember, Ice was on my list because she is just one of the really good souls on the team.
Yes.
She's not bombastic or a braggart or anything like that. She's heroic and a gentle soul as well. There's no doubt about that. They also, when artists do it right, they make her just downright gorgeous. They absolutely do. I love Ice so much. And so it's like, it's one of those things where I like the Guy and Ice relationship, especially when Ice is putting him in his place, which is probably because I want her to dump him. But she is a comic book character, I'm afraid. So it's like, I guess that's not going to happen. But, you know.
Well, to be more specific, she's a character in a sitcom. Is what it really is.
Well, and there is that, yes.
In sitcoms, you quite often have a character who shouldn't be in a relationship with somebody. And in real life, you wouldn't want them to be. But you know what? The jokes are funny, so they keep it going. And that's what's going on here. Ice and Guy should not be together. Clearly, in real life, we would all be doing what we could to help her realize it's a bad, unhealthy relationship. nostalgia. But you know what? It's darn funny in a sitcom, and that's why we put up with it, and that's why we love them for it.
Oh, that's true. And our sitcom characters as well is that we have our my man, Dimitri.
Yes.
Yes. When they find out about the Gray Man's about to open up the vats of chemicals, and Captain Atta says, Dimitri, go! And Dimitri says, not to worry, Chicky Baby. And John's like, Chicky Baby?
Right.
Oh, more hip American lingo. Dimitri, you are my man.
I hate to give you credit for anything because it like physically hurts me, but I have to say you opened my eyes to Dimitri quite a bit. Because
hey, social distancing. Come on.
we got to talk about that. But Dimitri, to me, I never really got that character. I thought, oh, he's the goofy one. He's the Yakov Smirnoff of the Justice League Europe, whatever. But
and he is. Yes.
He is. But there's a lot more to him. And I thank you for opening my eyes to see how much more there is to his character and how he, especially how he interacts with the rest of the team and how he treats it like a family. And he treats Batman just like a regular guy rather than Batman. You know, so I appreciate that. And I have a lot more love for Dimitri nowadays than I used to.
All I heard was that I was right about something. So, you know, I'm happy.
Yeah, I know. Like, yada, yada, yada. Tim was right. Yada, yada.
We can stop the show now. That's fine.
So, yeah. All right. So let's talk about the social distancing, all that. Here we sit. Tim and I recording.
Oh, yes.
This.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't know what the world is going to look like when this episode actually comes out, folks, because we're recording this pretty far in advance. So forgive me if the world has taken an even much darker turn, because it may. But at this point, we're sitting here talking about a comic book that's 30 plus years old, where some inexplicable virus is racing through Europe and killing tons and tons of people, which is like, wow, okay, I've heard this somewhere before. A little weird.
It seems a little familiar.
A little timely, sort of, this 30-year-old comic book. So weird. From those of us in the past, speaking to those of you in the future, we hope everyone is healthy and well and getting closer to the point where they can actually shake hands with each other once again.
Absolutely. So when Power Girl gets the big magic slap on her, there is a coloring mistake on that page, on that panel.
Really?
Because you see that her legs are the same color as her cape instead of being flesh colored.
Oh, interesting.
So I don't know where that came from. And that's on the digital single issue as well. Is that corrected in the...
It is corrected in the collected edition. Yeah, they spent a lot of time lovingly correcting all the mistakes in the collected edition.
Oh, yeah. Oh, also on the same page, it's because the fight with the Gray Man is really going down. And Guy Gardner just jumps in, as usual, just zapping the Gray Man on the nose, and the Gray Man's, like, not even reacting, and Gardner doesn't care. He's just so all in. He's not thrown. He's just like, I'm just going to take you on, man. I don't care.
Yeah, Guy's not going to back down from a fight.
Oh, no. That's what you like about him. You know, that's one thing you like about him, is that he's who you want on your side in a fight. You don't want him on the opposite side of a fight, that's for sure.
Right, and you don't want to ever probably hang out with a guy. But yeah, in a fight, that's where you want him, exactly.
No, you don't want to hang out with him unless you like to go to the red light district of town. That's what they
So we should talk for a second about this being J.M. DeMatteis' last issue. I mean, basically what it came down to was he was writing the Dr. Fate book, he was writing the Mr. Miracle book, he was writing the Justice League America book and Justice League Europe. It was just too much. So he had to step back from something. So he steps back here. Bill Mester Loebs comes in next issue, which is great because Bill Mester Loebs is writing the Flash book at this point.
Mm-hmm.
They even talk about this in letters pages at some point where basically they say, okay, we know you don't like the way we're handling the Flash. We got the Flash writer. And next issue, you'll see that, just peeking ahead. They spend a lot of time trying to sort of course correct with the Flash next issue, which is great.
Oh yeah, next issue is so good. Yeah.
There's a lot of family references in this issue I really like. That's been sort of a theme throughout the Teasdale Imperative, which is about the Justice League's being family. You get Mr. Miracle and Rocket Red both talking about their family, so I like that. That theme continues. A couple things. When the Lords of Order and Chaos show up, first of all, I love that we're hearing all the dialogue, and then they cut away, and Captain Atom and Martian Manhunter have no idea what the Lords of Order or Chaos are saying. It's a language they can't understand, and Martian Manhunter can't even read their minds, which I thought that was a really nice touch to be like, oh, okay, that makes sense that these beings who operate on a whole other plane is completely incomprehensible to humans. I love that. I love that a lot.
Oh, yeah. And they didn't do the brackets around the dialogue or anything to kind of imply a different language. They just left it. They just printed it like normal.
Yep.
But that kind of set it up so that we don't know that we can't understand them.
I dug that.
So, yeah, that's really good.
Now, the flip side of that, one thing that I don't exactly write is the Deus Ex Machina, where the Spectre shows shows up with the Lords of Order and Chaos. Now, within this single story, it's fine. But what that part that I don't like is that is basically exactly the same way they beat the Gray Man in Justice League International number 7, was the Lords of Order came in and smacked him down as well. So it's sort of like, okay, Gray Man shows up. Oh, surprise, he's the bad guy. Oh, Gray Man shows up. He's the bad guy. Gray Man gets defeated by the Lords of Order. Gray Man gets defeated by the Lords of Order and Chaos. So it's that's the only thing I didn't like about that, is that it basically ends the same way.
I feel that too. But also, I don't really see where they gave us any opening for another way for it to be solved. It's not like we had any other hint of, you know, there's no MacGuffin. We just get this thing. We can take him out.
Yes, right. And the art. I've said it before, and I'll probably say it every issue that Bart Sears draws. Rocket Red and Captain Atom have never looked better except under Bart Sears' pencil. And, you know, Captain Atom with the sepitone and stuff, the gorgeous shininess of both of them, they look amazing. So good. I also really like Martian Manhunter. He gives them that sort of like Cro-Magnon eyebrows that Bart Sears is so good at doing. I just think they look really, really good on Martian Manhunter. And you don't see that reflected in the Adam Hughes stuff. He has a much more subdued brow there. I prefer the giant brow.
Yeah, it's really nice. It gets the full-on beetle brow look is just in full force with Bart Sears.
A couple other just small notes, like page 6, you get a shot of the Gray Man close up of his face. It's almost like half a page, and it's a shot of, like, there's a background shot going on, and then he's sort of a foreground shot, just him staring at you with his head tilted down. Looks like something out of a horror movie. It looks great. It just shows Bart Sears' sort of versatility, because, you know, a lot of people say that all his faces look the same. Well, here's an example of it not looking the same. I think there's some opportunities in here where he's trying to show women's faces looking different, like Ice and Power Girl have very different looking faces in here. Now, some of that might be Bob Smith. I don't know. What'd you think of Bob Smith's inking versus, like, maybe an Art Nichols or a Paolo Marcos?
Well, I really liked it in this issue. I mean, I'll say that. Unfortunately, I don't have as good an eye for picking out the inking differences as strongly as some people. But it came through really nicely here. Yeah, like, the Gray Man's nose in that one panel you're talking about, is like, it's so distinctive. It's like, yeah, it doesn't look like any other faces in there. And, you know, like, Teasdale, oh, he looks completely different.
Right.
It's like, but it's almost easy because he's a caricature, practically.
That's true.
But it's like, you're still not going to confuse Gray Man with Captain Atom or Mr. Miracle's faces. It's like, duh.
Kind of looks like that dude from the Phantasm movies, really, a little bit, but...
Oh, interesting.
So the only thing I'm going to say about this is this period in Justice League International history, you've got Adam Hughes drawing JLA. You've got Bart Sears drawing Justice League Europe. Both in 1989, it's sort of kind of the height of some of their powers. You got Giffen and DeMatteis right here. I mean, specifically this month, this is like an embarrassment of riches going on here of creative talent. It's astonishing how much talent is on the Justice League books right now. And it is awesome. And there are a lot of different golden ages of this era, but we are definitely in one of the golden ages of the Justice League Bwahaha era. It's beautiful. I love it.
Well said, sir. Yeah.
So I think that's going to round out our coverage of this specific issue. So here we are at the end of the crossover. Tim, any thoughts on the overall Teasdale Imperative, how you feel about it?
Well, at the end, I really enjoyed the whole thing because we have a foe that really does make sense for the combined JLI to be fighting, because the original team couldn't take him out by themselves at all back in JLI number 6 and 7. Mm-hmm. It makes sense for him to be the foe that the combined team is there for. I really enjoyed the whole thing in that. That gave it a scope. The stakes were high-ish, but it was still darn fun. And we got to see lots of interactions with the teams and individuals within the teams interacting with different characters than they normally do. So that was always good stuff to see. And it actually being some consequences, like you said before, of Power Girl, you know, she's not in good shape. Right. And we don't know what's going to happen next issue. So it's not over. And we're at the end of this issue and it is not over. So I just love that. But unfortunately, one thing I have to say is that I can't hear Teasdale without thinking of the Monty Python's Flying Circus bit of an enormous hedgehog who's named Spiny Norman appearing in London saying, Dinsdale.
Oh my gosh, I don't even remember that bit, but okay. Yeah, so
that was the Piranha Brothers pseudo-documentary that they had in their show.
Okay.
And they ended the episode with this animation of a hedgehog going throughout London, just poking his head over various buildings. That doesn't help that the Gray Man is also giant size as well in the same thing.
That's right. There's the parallel. Yeah.
Teasdale. But I was like, I don't think it's the same thing. I know it's not. I know it has no relation to it, but that's just like where my brain goes.
Fair enough. I think that's a little bit of a window into your soul that all of us wish we didn't know, but okay.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Well, I've been promising for the first 3 installments of this crossover that I would share my thoughts at the end. So here we go. Going into
I get to hear them. Oh, good.
going into this, I was not very excited about covering the Teasdale Imperative. I had remembered it was like kind of so-so, like I felt let down way back in 89 for some reason. I know it's also got not the best reputation. And when you ask people, I mean, even some of the comments people have left over the last couple of months going, oh, you know, a less than stellar crossover or whatever. But now that I've read it, and also anytime, here's a little tip for you non-podcasters, anytime you do a podcast on a comic book, you spend way more time analyzing it and thinking about the comic than you have any right to do, or that the writers ever intended anyone to spend that much time on a 22-page funny book. But you do. You analyze it. You break it down. You go, why did the writer do this? Why did this happen? How is this structured? And when you do that and you break it down, you really, I find a lot of stuff to love with this crossover, actually. I love the idea that they're just trying to save a small group of people in Europe. They don't even know that it's a world-shaking situation until the very end. At this point, they're willing to die to save the people of these small villages. It doesn't matter whether it's 10 million people in New York or a couple hundred people in wherever this is in Kosovo. So the fact that the scale is at a low level and the heroes are still willing to do it means a lot to me. I like that aspect of it. You mentioned the parallels of the Gray Man. All that makes sense. The interactions between the characters are really what makes this whole thing fantastic. In a lot of ways, it's sort of like, and I think I said this in the recording of the first part of this episode, but what makes the JLI so great is the interactions between the battles. You know, we always say it's a workplace comedy and what takes place in between the fights. Well, that's kind of where this crossover shines too, is in between the fight, you see these great moments, even during the fight sometimes, but the great moments between the characters. The character interplay is what makes this crossover such a huge success. So I actually, walking away from it, I love this crossover now. I think it's fantastic, and I think it's a perfect way for the Justice Leagues to meet. It doesn't have to be Starro. It doesn't have to be a Mazo. It doesn't have to be, you know, an alpha level threat. Well, the Gray Man does turn out to be that, but it works for me, and I'm satisfied.
Nice.
Well, with all of that oxygen expended and me talking way too much, I'm going to turn it over to Tim in a segment I like to call
Character Spotlight.
This is where Tim is going to be asked to share some thoughts on a particular character from the issue. Not really an origin recap, but more about where the characters were in the DC universe before they interacted with the JLI, and what kind of impact the JLI may have had on their careers or whatever. Tim, why don't you tell us a little bit about the Spectre?
Ah, certainly. Debuting in 1940, we have murdered police detective Jim Corrigan is returned to Earth by The Voice to exact vengeance on the guilty and the evil as The Spectre. And he's one of the most powerful beings in the DC universe. Until, following his failure to prevent the destruction of the multiverse in Crisis, his powers were greatly reduced, Corrigan and the Spectre existing as two entities, and it's painful for the Spectre to leave Corrigan's body. So that series debuted within a month of Justice League number one.
Wow, I didn't realize that. Okay.
Yeah, it's crazy. It featured lots of DC's magic users, and it had Corrigan run a private agency investigating mystical threats. So according to Mike's Amazing World of Comics, that series ended with issue number 31, which came out the same day as this issue of JLE.
Whoa, synchronicity there.
Oh yeah, it's crazy time. So aside from this story, the Spectre had really little dealings with the JLI. They appeared in the same big events like Millennium and Invasion, but not on panel together. Dr. Fate did pop up in some of Spectre's series, and the old school JLA favorites like Zatanna and Phantom Stranger were semi-regulars. But there's really no other JLA, JLE interactions with the Spectre. But a notable point is that Spectre's issue number 24 introduced the character Praxis.
Oh, yeah!
Future member of the Conglomerate from JL Quarterly number 1. And now guest star in DCU's Harley Quinn series. Things didn't go well for Praxis there.
I wholeheartedly endorse the Harley Quinn animated series, by the way. I went into it not wanting to enjoy it. I sort of hate watched the first episode because somebody made me. It's freaking hilarious. And when Praxis showed up, I lost my freaking mind. So yeah, definitely check it out, guys. But don't watch it around the kids. Not at all.
No. Do not watch it around the kids. It's a little heavy on that sort of HBO style humor, violence. I just didn't stop watching it, did I? No. So that's pretty, it was wild stuff. And Praxis being there was just like, that is a deep cut. Yes. Oh my goodness. So that was really it up through the end of Spectre's series. Now that his next series, The Spectre was brought back to his roots and original power levels, and that series was written by John Ostrander and art by Tom Mandrake. That was shortly after their work on Some Guy Whose Hair's on Fire. I don't know who that might have been.
Yeah, I don't know. I've never heard of anybody whose hair's on fire or anything like that that they worked on. But I do know after Spectre, they went on to work on a Martian Manhunter series. So it's all full circle.
There is that, too. And that's it for the Spectre.
I love the character. I'm a big fan of the JSA. Boy, the stories from the 1970s by Jim Aparo and Michael Fleischer are so stinking good. Oh, so neat character. And thanks for that recap. That was awesome. And I had completely forgotten until you brought up that Praxis premiered in the Spectre series. That's awesome.
Oh, yeah. I was not reading the Spectre series, but I did find that out. And I do need to put that on my reading projects for the DCU app, going through that Spectre series.
Oh, good idea. Good idea.
Yeah.
There's some amazing artwork in that series, too.
And the DCU app is just not very good for someone with my addictions.
Moving from that segment to another one, folks, it is time, the moment you've all been waiting for. It's time for the Pwahaha Award. Now, this is where we are going to nominate the funniest moment in the issue. Both myself and Tim are going to pick one moment, and only one will be awarded the coveted Bwahaha Award. Tim, you're the guest. This is your very first podcast you've ever done, so you have the honor of naming your Bwahaha Award first.
And it's about daggum time.
Right.
So, all right. So, what am I going to go to? Well, you know my love of Dimitri. And ironically, you know that I did that episode with you with Mr. Miracle. You should remember that by now.
I do.
My moment happens to include both of them. And page 7, the top panel, very first panel on that page, we have Mr. Miracle saying, maybe they're never going to move. Maybe we'll just stay up here circling forever. And Dimitri, we should be so lucky. You know, I'd give anything to be back home in Bailey with Barda and Oberon, and I to be in Moscow with Sonya and the children. Well, I don't know about Oberon. Well, I don't know about Moscow. And
it's a good bit.
I love that bit. It's like in the middle of all this, and they're wishing for their family, but they're also like, well, maybe not everything. That cracks me up every time.
That is a good joke. It's not the best one in the book, but that's a good one.
I beg to differ. I will need some evidence that it's not the best in the book.
Well, if you need evidence, sir, just fast forward to page 14. It is the Bambi versus Godzilla moment. I mean, that is such a what? You know, Teasdale, his name, the crossover is Teasdale imperative. And you get to the big confrontation. He's about to kill Simon Stagg and Java, which probably we would all cheer for. But anyway, you get to that big moment and boom, he's taken off the table in the most dramatic, shocking, gruesome, you know, in but also wildly hysterical way. So it is horrifying and gross, but it is also riotously funny. So I can't possibly in good conscience pass this opportunity for the Teasdale imperative to nominate the Teasdale death. So, you got a long road to convince me that that other joke, which is funny, is better than this one.
I see. Okay. All right. Now, let me just think this through, because yes, your moment is funny. I'm not going to deny it. It's quite funny.
Now, Tim, I got to warn you. Fair warning, our buddy Chris Lewis has been keeping track of every single one of the Bwahaha Award winners. He's got a spreadsheet. It's in the show notes, folks. If you haven't seen it, you got to go see it. It's a Google Doc. It is hilarious. Not only does he say which scenes were nominated, he's got some funny commentary in there. It's great. I absolutely love it. Chris, thank you so much for doing it. But I was reviewing it, and I noticed I have lost a lot recently. So I'm not terribly fond of rolling over on this one right now. I'm warning you going in. So you're going to have to really work to convince me. What do you got, buddy?
Oh, come on. You're the host of the show. You should be fine with that sort of thing. You should be a giver. You know, you're giving a guest.
I've given a lot lately.
What a good host are supposed to give to the guests. I think that's how that's supposed to work.
Did you see the spread in the green room? I give enough.
Yeah, but I'm not really into this, you know, organic stuff over here. What the heck?
My wife's a vegan. She does the shopping. I can't control that.
I'm just offering that the fact that, you know, because Bwahaha, you're going for the joke and the dialogue. It's right there. It's gold right there. Because we got the setup and we got the bit and then repeat of the bit.
Yeah.
We got the repeat of the bit right there. And it's all in one panel. And it happens like boom, boom, boom. You know, that's good Abbott and Costello action right happening right there.
I will give you that it is comedy gold. It absolutely is. It is well structured. It's well put together. It is comedy gold. The stomping of Teasdale is comedy platinum, though. I got it. Come on, man. It is... We spent so much time talking about it already earlier. You got to give it to me.
Well, the only reason we talked about it earlier was because it was gross. So, you know. And because it's part of the horror look of the book, too. However, I am willing to concede the bwahaha to your moment.
Thank you. Boy, that took a lot longer than it should have. Oh, my gosh.
I don't think so. I think that was probably just about the right amount of time.
Well, our congratulations to Teasdale, or what's left of him, and the Gray Man. You have won the coveted bwahaha award. Please wear it with pride. It is as tangible as the laughter we give you. Now, with all of that done, Tim, I've been waiting to talk to you about something else. Now, you've mentioned a couple times you're a computer programmer, which really is sort of advantageous at this moment.
Why?
Well, what? You know how people love to ask their friends to help with computers? Sue Dibney, she's been working on the mainframe, and she's found some bugs. She's got a problem, and she was wondering if you could help out in the server room. By the way, it's in the basement of the embassy, of course, but it may be a little loud in there, but if you could help her out, it would really be appreciated.
Oh, God. I hate server rooms. They're just noise constantly, and the air conditioning always is running, even when it's 50 degrees in there. Oh, fine. For Sue, I'll do it. Perfect. I'll do it for Sue.
Excellent. Exactly as I planned it. Folks, just remember, if you have any friends that work in the IT industry, they love helping you fix their computer. So, and don't worry, Tim, we will bring you back at the end of the show. And folks, while Tim's taking care of that, I'm going to read your listener feedback in a segment called Justice Log. All right, folks, you already heard the promo for JL May, but I want to give you a heads up. I will be appearing on a few different shows, including over on Views from the Long Box. I will be on the episode that will be discussing Countdown to Infinite Crisis. Yes, I will be weighing in on the infamous issue that features Blue Beetle and Maxwell Lord in a story that some of us may wish was imaginary. So check that out over on Views from the Long Box in JL May. Now remember, get out on the social medias, use our hashtag #FWPodcast or tag us JLI Podcast, or leave your comments on our website, because we want to hear from you, because it's all about building a community of online JLI fans around this show. Now, we're going to get into your comments. These are coming from our website, email, social media, and such. And I'm going to be just pulling bits and pieces of it, because there's so much feedback that it would take forever to read all of it. I'm going to be discussing our most recent episode covering JLA number 31 with my guest host, Jose Rivera, and JLE number 7 with my guest host, Scott X. First off, we heard from Joshua Romano, and he says, I've been going quarantine crazy. No beer and no TV makes Homer something, something, something. And then he addressed where I had talked about how fans in the 90s just turned against the JLI just viciously. They went from loving the book to hating it. He chimes in and says, I remember when fans turned against the JLI. I attributed it to newer fans who were all caught up in the extreme 90s, and anything that wasn't grim and gritty and pouch covered was bad. You know, Joshua, I think you're absolutely right. If it wasn't extreme, then they just didn't like it. Then Joshua goes on to say, incidentally, when Neil Gaiman references the collection of dream essence by the Lords of Order, he mocks them for trying to bribe him with something so worthless. Gaiman's depiction of the Lords of Order as inept helps support an explanation of why they keep selecting bad gray men who go rogue. That's a good thought. Very insightful. Then we heard from Dan S. Now, if you remember in the last episode's feedback, we talked a little bit about a fanzine. And he says, I did some digging online, and the blue and gold fanzine was called The Booster Brigade. There's some info about it. And he gives a link to our buddy's website, boosterific.com. And he says, I remember it had articles, fan art, and its own letter column. It was typed and arrived in overstuffed number 10 envelopes. Thanks, Dan. Appreciate that. So be sure to check out that Boosterific link, folks. It's on the comments from the last episode. Then we heard from our buddy Michael Kramer. He goes, yes, Adam Hughes. When I was first starting to collect the back issues of JLI in 1992 and 93, I collected mostly from Adam Hughes's run, so the only Maguire books I had were the two trades. Also, having collected the Who's Who Loose Leaf run, I was already somewhat acquainted with his work, with the pinups he did for Fire, Ice, Big Barda, Phantom Lady, and among others. On a mildly unrelated note, I'm happy to say I just got the DC Heroes Justice League source book. Oh, that's fantastic. He's talking about the the role-playing game from Mayfair Games. They did a Justice League International Sourcebook that my buddy Siskoid and I actually covered on an episode of our Hero Points podcast, and we addressed the JLI aspects of it. So it's kind of a companion piece to this podcast. You might want to check it out on Hero Points. Hope you enjoy that book, Michael. Then we heard from Damian Whiter from our England embassy. He says, I can confirm that Adam Hughes draws men just as sexily as he draws women. Mr. Miracle, Blue Beetle, and Booster Gold are all very hot in JLA number 31. Huh. Thank you, Damian, for confirming that. Then we heard from David Ace Gutierrez, owner and operator of the Katana Banana Fruit Stand, which incidentally now offers curbside pickup. He says, great show, old man. Great show. Why did I bother reading that? Although, that is probably the nicest thing he said to me all month. If you read the text messages I get from this guy, you would blanch from horror. All right, up next is Max Traver. He goes, the Night Stacker. I don't know if you remember, we were talking about Kolchek the Night Stalker, and we misspoke and said Night Stacker on the last episode with Scott X, and we decided he works in grocery stores, that Night Stacker. Max says, the Night Stacker is the hero we need at this moment in history, folks. Then Scott X chimed in, yeah, no kidding. I was walking through the barren toilet paper aisle earlier today. Call in the Night Stacker. That is definitely the hero we need right now. Then I heard from the other guest from last episode, Jose Rivera, and he says, gotta say, it was a lot of fun to record this episode with Shag. I'm not used to recording podcasts like everyone else, but getting to talk about my love of the JLI made it all the more special. Oh, Jose, it was a blast having you on the show. So glad you get to be here, buddy. Then we heard from our buddy Chris Franklin, who's part of the Fire and Water Podcast Network. He does shows such as the JLU Cast, and he just recently uploaded a video to our YouTube channel. So check that out. It's Fire and Water Podcast Network. We have a YouTube channel, and he uploaded a video of his toy room that is amazing. So, and Chris, of course, does a whole bunch more in our network. Chris says, listening now, but something jumped out at me looking at the gallery images. I haven't read these comics in ages, and since then I became aware of Milton Bradley's Starbird Avenger electronic spaceship from the 1970s, trying to cash in on the Star Wars craze. Apparently, Adam Hughes was also a fan. Yeah, Chris, I totally remember that ship. I had one growing up, and you can totally see it in Adam Hughes' artwork. Now, thinking back, I think Mike Harlow and I made a comment about that when we did the Dr. Fate episode about a year ago, and I want to say even then Sean McManus was drawing the ship just like Adam Hughes was, and we noticed it then. But yeah, I'm pretty sure Adam Hughes is the one who developed that design. Then Chris goes on to say, I think Adam Hughes gets away with cheesecake because there is an undercurrent of empowerment for the females he depicts. They're always in control, often dominating the hapless males in the images. I certainly didn't mind the way he draws women, and honestly still don't. His looks for Fire and Ice carry over into the JLU as well, so we'll see them in animation there. You know, that's a great point. I completely forgot about that, that those costumes were so iconic that, yeah, they carried over to animation. Then Scott X, our guest last episode, chimes in, Chris, great pickup. I had the Starbird as a kid, though as you said, it was created to cash in on the Star Wars craze. I already had some of the Star Wars ships to play with, so this ship doubled as my Battlestar Galactica. Not to scale with my Colonial Viper, but you do what you have to do. That's awesome. Then we heard from Liz Ann Oswalt, who has her own YouTube channel. Now, if you remember last episode, we talked about how Fire was sort of baiting Booster Gold, trying to get him to notice her new costume. And Liz writes, aw, Booster being Booster. Wait, Fire gave Booster a free horn dog moment and he fumbled the ball? Sigh. Booster is losing his touch. Great commentary, Liz. Then she goes on to address the issue where we're talking about how the JLA use their code names in battle, whereas the Justice League Europe uses their real names. And she says, JLA probably doesn't use their real name because the villain might hear them. Kind of like when Barry got annoyed at Hal for using his first name when they fought Bats in the New 52. So yeah, probably best if they don't use their real names in public. Shocked that Jean or Bats didn't get annoyed that the Justice League Europe were using their real names. Good point. You think they would have mentioned something. Thanks, Liz. Appreciate it. Then we heard from Martin Gray, who does the Too Dangerous for Girl blog. He's in our Scottish embassy. Martin says, I always assumed the Teasdale Imperative as a title was a play on all those manly Robert Ludlum novels, such as The Holcraft Covenant, The Bourne Supremacy, The Scarlatti Inheritance, and The Poodle Conundrum. I'm not sure if Poodle Conundrum was one of those, but I haven't read a lot of Robert Ludlum books, so thank you, Martin. Anyway, Martin goes on to say, congratulations to both guests for their wit and insight. Jose made a superb debut, and Scott's pointing out the Kubert-ness of the JLE cover was a highlight of the episode. It jogged a memory or two and sent me out straight to the comic book database to see if I could find an original that spawned the likely homage. I'm not convinced I did. See my exchanges with Scott on Twitter, but I had loads of fun. Yeah, folks, if you go out to Twitter back in March, you can see this great correspondence between between Martin Gray and Scott X, where they just shared a bunch of like G.I. Combat and Sergeant Rock and Son of Tomahawk covers, all sort of emulating last month's JLE issue cover. So it was really cool. Thanks, guys. Then we're from a new listener, and I apologize in advance. I'm going to slaughter your last name, Cassie, but I'm going to try. Cassie Devereaux? Maybe that's how you say it? Anyway, Cassie does the Red Stripe podcast. She says, discovered your whole host of podcasts, and your voice talking about the comics I love are a companion in this very dark time. What better time to hear geeks enthusing about the Bwahaha League? It's making me smile at the time when smiles are few. I appreciate it. Aw, thank you so much for the comment, Cassie, and thanks for listening. Then I heard from Tim Price. I have no idea who this is. Maybe he's new. I don't know. Anyway, this mysterious Tim Price person writes in to say, okay, new thought about Max getting Huntress to join the JLI. We just finished getting Beetle deprogrammed from the Queen Bee, meaning mind-controlled, and that's when Max pushed Helena? What a hypocrite. Jeez. Yeah, Max mind-controlling Huntress into joining the team just gets uglier and uglier the more we look at it. By the way, that's going to come up during JL May over on the Views from the Long Box when we talk about Countdown to Infinite Crisis and what Max does to Beetle. Anyway, Tim then continues to say, I looked it up and Bart Sears had drawn one issue of the Spectre before this series. So yes, he would have rocked a Spectre series. Awesome. Thanks so much, mysterious Tim person that I've never heard of. Then we heard from Doug Van Diver. Doug says, if a containment suit or spacesuit needed to be worn by a Kelly Jones depiction of Batman, then I imagine those giant bat ears that Jones drew would have, would have to wrap around the sides of Bruce's head like ram horns. And then he says, okay, now I have to go draw that in fan art. Oh, that's hilarious. Thank you so much, Doug. Then we heard from Jimmy McGlinchey from the Irish Embassy. Jimmy writes, Irish Embassy here, and with the Teasdale Imperative sweeping the continent, the Irish Embassy is fully stocked up to take care of the vampire threat. We have garlic, toilet paper, holy water, toilet paper, crosses, toilet paper, silver bullets, toilet paper, and of course, toilet paper. Oh, Jimmy, you cracked me up. He says, I really enjoyed the first two issues of the Teasdale Imperative. The Adam Hughes artwork on JLA number 31 was an exceptional debut for someone who was only making his first DC work. He really hit the ground running with this art. Despite the lack of the JLE in this book, I felt this chapter was a good opener to the crossover. In fact, the lack of JLE in this story gave it a sense of ominousness, especially inserted with the cutaways of the Spectre and the Gray Man, Oberon and Max, and Sue and Catherine talking, in that whether the JLE had fallen to the forces that they were sent to investigate. You know, Jimmy, you bring a different perspective, and I appreciate that, because a lot of us have said the JLA number 31 issue didn't really feel like it needed to be part of the crossover, but you're absolutely right. The framework was there. It gave the sense. It gave the sort of foreboding. So yeah, all right. You've sold me. Thank you so much, Jimmy. I appreciate the other viewpoint. Then we heard from Evertom Vieira do Carmo from our Brazilian embassy. And they write, so happy that you guys are finally on Spotify. Awesome. Yes, folks, remember, we are on Spotify, Stitcher, and Google Podcasts now if you are looking for another place to find it. And glad that you're enjoying it on Spotify. That's awesome. Thank you so much. Anyway, Evertom goes on to say, I am not a big fan of this crossover, but I agree that it would have made an excellent Dr. Fate story with the JLE and JLA as guest stars. That's a fair opinion. Now, I do feel differently after finishing the whole crossover. I love it now, but I see what you're saying, that there is a lot of Dr. Fate-ishness in it. Yeah. Then Evertom continues, about the Lords of Order being incompetent, I challenge you to find a powerful entity from the DC Universe that is not, and I'm looking at you, Guardians of the Universe. Very fair observation. Thank you so much. Then we heard from Bradley Null. Bradley goes, OMG! This is where some of my earliest fan fights started because of its political stance. My pal Z was not happy about the Dr. Fate switch-up. This is 1989, so I might have been having this argument in a BBS forum as well. Z called it a feminist doctrine gone too far. He had forgotten my interest in comics started with my feminist mom's love for Wonder Woman. I personally love it when we get a new version of a JSA character. I used to argue with people who didn't, but the fights were rarely worth my time. The saddest part is I don't remember the comic, just the first fight. Aw, that is sad, Bradley, but I am glad to hear you stood up for the female Dr. Fate. That's fantastic. Then we heard from Symbol Pending, who runs the Power Girl blog. They write, your mention of reading comics in strange places reminds me of something I'd not thought of for quite a while. Back in the day, I house sat for a friend's grotty little flat with only a single heater to keep the room anything approaching warm. The reason I remember is that he also had a full, at the time, run of Sandman, and I spent a cold night working my way through them all. Probably my first Vertigo, and I probably have a soft spot for Sandman for that reason. Thanks for reminding me of that and putting up with my ramblings. Well, they're not ramblings, Symbol Pending, and I love that story. And by the way, I'm just going to say, hold on for your love of Sandman, because there might be something about that in a future episode. Anyway, Sybil Penning goes on to say, Adam Hughes is an artist that does a lot of Power Girl art, to get back to my theme, including covers of the series that cemented my love for Power Girl. I don't have much memorabilia, but I do have a bust of Power Girl that's based on his artwork. Wow, that's cool, Sybil Penning. Thanks for sharing. Then we heard from Mike Dynas from the Canadian Embassy. Mike says, I do remember buying the JLA issue from the stands as I did a cartoon double take when I saw Dr. Fate on the cover. I enjoyed Dr. Fate in the early issues of JL/JLI, so this was quite the difference. I wasn't reading the Dr. Fate monthly book at the time, so I didn't know what was going on, but I remember not having a problem at all thinking that this was a neat turn on a classic character. Or maybe it was just the Adam Hughes art and I was in my early teens. Then Mike goes on to say, I also remember this JLA issue got me to start collecting JLE as I didn't want to miss out on the Teasdale Imperative. Look at that. Crossovers work, people. Then we're from Mike Zomkowski. He says, thanks for carrying on and giving us some joy. Really enjoying this crossover. It sets the tone for how they interact moving forward. You know, it does. The nice moments where the JLE and the JLA are hanging out and talking does sort of establish their relationship for going forward. I agree, Mike. Then we're from James Simpson, who goes, this story is so good. Everyone remembers the Bwahaha moments, and then people reference the Despero storyline for a dark story, but this, I thought, was a healthy balance of the two, and the impact on a certain super character was long-lasting. You're absolutely right, James. Then Adam Ackerman, our buddy from the Denmark Embassy, he's been doing these Facebook posts that I love where he calls them social distancing JLI puzzle. And you can find these, go over to the JLI Facebook page and then go over to the community area. You'll see where he's posting these. He takes these photos really close up of HeroClix. And what he does is he focuses in on just one part of a costume, and they're always a JLI character. And you got to figure out which JLI character it is from this little tiny photo. It's fun. I appreciate it. It's something to do and something to keep us happy in these troubled times. So thank you, Adam. I appreciate it. We also got some nice comments from JT the Exterminator, Hoover Jeremiah, Justin Steiner, Aaron Head Moss, Matthew Cody, and George William. Thank you for those comments, guys. I really appreciate it. Now, this is the part of the show where I thank everyone who shared the JLI podcast on their social media timeline, and I'm referring to Facebook or Twitter. And now I know it's a long list of names, and I say this every single episode, folks, but these people showed their support. They are helping to promote the show. They're helping to reach new JLI fans, and we're bringing new people in, and it's important to me that we recognize these people. So this time out, we're looking at over 60 names of people who helped promote the last episode. Our thanks to Al Gerding, Professor Alan Middleton and his Relatively Geeky Podcast Network, Between the Pages, the Blue Beetle and Booster Gold Facebook group, Canadian Geek, Changing Shades, Chris Franklin, Chris from BTO and the Bat Books, Chris Lewis, Chris Lydon, Clinton Robinson and the Coffee and Comics Podcast, Dale Russell, Damian Whiter, DC Now, a DC fan podcast, Derek J. Wyatt, Chuck Coletta and his Dr. Pop Culture Bowling Green State University account, Dr. Jennifer Swartz Levine, Green Lantern HG, Gus Casals, Jack Rocha, Jared Albrecht, the yard sale artist, Jeff Messer, and also his Issues With account, Joe Tonello, Jose Rivera, Joshua Ox, Keechee Baker, Kyle Benning and his King Size Comics Giant Size Fun podcast, Liz Ann Oswalt, Luke Dobb, Martin Koger, Matthew Cody, Max Romero and his It's Plastic Man and the Mirror Factory accounts, Michael Kramer, Mike Dynas, Nuno Duarte, Darren and Ruth Sutherland and their Rat Adventures, Warlock World, and Xenozoic Xenophiles accounts, Retro Cabal, Rob Kelly and his accounts, Digest Cast, Film and Water Podcast, For All Mankind Super Friends Podcast, Mashcast, Pod Dylan, Superman Movie Minute, Aquaman Shrine, and Treasury Comics. Roger Preeb, Scott X, Sean Ross and his Secret Wars and Beyond podcast, Siskoid, The Red Stripe, Tim Price, Al Sedano and his Warlock and Thanos podcast, Willie Yarbrough and Zach Sally. Woof! My thanks to all of you for your support of the JLI podcast. Your feedback is such a critical part of the show, and this community of JLI fans we're building together is absolutely fantastic. Now, if I've forgotten or missed anyone, I am terribly sorry. It's probably the fault of Jose Rivera or Scott X. If so, just drop me a line and let me know, and I'll be sure to include you on the next episode. Please keep those cards and letters coming, everyone. Our website is fireandwaterpodcast.com/JLI. Leave comments on the show post there. Over on Facebook, you can find us as Justice League International, Bwahaha Podcast. On Twitter, we're JLI Podcast. Or you can email us at JLIPodcast@gmail.com. My thanks again to Jose Rivera and Scott X for helping me cover JLA number 31 and JLE number 7. And thanks to you listeners for such a great collection of feedback from that episode. You guys are the best. Now, we're going to take a quick podcast promo break, and when we come back, we'll see if we can bring Jeff and Tim together in the same embassy.
Born out of violence, adopted in chaos, Teenager Cassandra Cain is seeking the answer to a question. If nurture can undo nature, raised to be an assassin, Cassandra is trying to burn the pages of her past and write a whole new future.
So
you can write to us at thehuntresspodcast.com or go to Twitter at Huntress Podcast. We're on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and your other podcatchers. This podcast shares a feed with the Huntress Podcast, the Batgirl Cassandra Cain Podcast. Cheers.
Okay, all right. Okay, Lantern Cast promo. Action Comics Weekly promo, there it is. Okay. Alright, what's the date on this thing? June 23rd, 2016. Alright, let's take a look at this thing. Oh yeah, Bowie! Not a bad choice.
Hey everybody, I'm Chad Bokelman. You may know me from the Green Lantern podcast, The Lantern Cast. You also may know me from making promises across the comics podcasting community concerning a new project I've been working on. An Action Comics Weekly podcast, to be precise. Well, it's time to deliver on that promise.
Oh, promises,
the
promises.
The Action Comics Weekly podcast is a bi-weekly podcast featuring myself and a rotating cast of semi-regular co-hosts.
Semi-regular?
Discussing the characters.
Oh, no, hold on. Oh, I have had just about enough of that. Okay, first of all, you barely got 5 episodes in. So what in the world are you talking about on delivering on promises, let alone a bi-weekly schedule? And semi-regular co-hosts? Okay, listen, youngin, you're not Ryan Friggin' Daly. You had basically the same guest on for each character almost every time, and you know it. So let me just apologize to you all by way of, you know, reality for once. Look, life happens, but the Action Comics Weekly podcast is coming back. Segments are being recorded, and the only thing I'm shooting for is quality episodes, not a schedule. So find the Action Comics Weekly podcast very soon in places like Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Because the show is back, but this time with less youthful ego, I hope.
Okay, folks, we're back from break, and yes, it does appear that the JLI teleporter has brought together both Jeff and Tim. Awesome. First, ooh, Jeff, thank you so much for appearing on this episode of the show. I can't tell you how much fun it's been. I'm so glad we finally got this chance to record together. Now, why don't you tell the folks at home where they can find you or your works on the interwebs?
Well, thank you so much, Shag, and thanks for leaving me with all those light bulbs to screw in. That was no small task.
You could have waited until next issue and just got Kilowog to help you, but whatever.
What was I thinking? Jeez. And now you tell me. Okay, so if people want to find me, you can find me. I'm pretty easy to find on social media. Facebook, you can find me. I also run the Masterstroke Studios Mike Grell Universe Facebook page. I run the Robin Hood Comic Book Adventures Facebook page. Facebook is like a billboard to just advertise myself shamelessly to the world. And so it's an embarrassment of riches, but I'm all over that. You can follow me on Twitter, which I really try to avoid because my blood pressure can't take it.
Right.
But on Twitter and on Instagram, at Jeff Douglas Mess, M-E-S-S. Just seemed like an appropriate handle to grab.
You beat me to the joke. Thank you so much.
Exactly.
Well, thanks again, Jeff. I sincerely appreciate it.
It's my pleasure. Hopefully you'll have me back at some point down the road. I do light bulbs. I don't do windows.
Well, as far as you coming back, no way in hell.
Well, thank you so much.
Tim, thanks so much for being on this episode. I got to tell you, again, it is so special to me that this was your very first podcast ever. I'm so glad to be part of that and helping to introduce you to the podcast universe. So welcome. In that regard, again, being that it's your first podcast, you might not have a lot to pimp, but please, if you can, tell the listeners where they might find some of your activities online.
Now, Shag, I know it was only 3 hours ago when we started this, but I think you should be able to remember by now that I do have a few things out there. So, but for the folks at home, you can find me on Twitter at TimPrice17 or on Facebook at Tim Price. And I'm also the regular co-host on the Batgirl Cassandra Cain podcast with Ashford Wright of the Right On Network. And that shares a feed with his Huntress podcast, and the website is www.thehuntresspodcast.com.
I kind of feel like you're cheating on me a little bit there is what that feels like, but all right, whatever.
Just roll over and go to sleep. It'll be fine.
Yikes. Sound like he was talking from experience there, folks. There you go. Go ahead.
And on April 1st of this year, I recorded a podcast episode with Al Sedano of the Adam Warlock Thanos Resurrections podcast, and has a very original pairing of characters, Namor and the Ghost Rider. So go check it out.
That would be one water character and one fire character? Is that what you're trying to say?
Yes. I'm surprised that you caught on to that.
Interesting. Yes, okay.
I thought that might be a little over your head, but that's okay. That's fine.
Please continue fanning the flame and riding the wave of your pimping. Finish up.
Oh, certainly. Well, I did want to say that this show is a long time coming, but we finally got to this episode. Woohoo!
Yay!
So thanks for agreeing to have me on so long ago and starting me on this descent into the madness of podcasting.
In all seriousness, I did take a chance on you 3 years ago when I booked you for the show.
Yes, you did. I don't know what you were thinking.
Well, no, the interactions we had had, the comments we'd gone back and forth on, the stuff on social media, it was always great interacting with you. And now I am thrilled to be able to say that I count you amongst my friends. I mean, we have recorded other shows together. We have hung out in the same room together for hours at a time. Mm-hmm. We've walked convention floors ridiculous amount of times. And it's been a blast. And I'm glad we've got a chance to get to know each other, sir.
I couldn't agree more, man. I mean, the thing is, this is the first podcast I ever listened to.
Really?
I know I said that before. Yes, I hadn't listened to any podcast before this show. And so this made me really fall in love with podcasting and find podcasts that were actually out there that interested me. I had no idea they would be out there. So yes, and it's been just fantastic to meet and hang out with you, to be at conventions and I'd be at a table and you just show up minutes after I was already like talking about and bragging about one of your shows. So, you know, you're welcome.
Well, thank you.
But also getting to know and meeting other podcasters and just growing into part of this, as you like to say it, this community. It's been one of the real great joys for me of the last few years. So thank you for bringing me on board and thank you for being my friend.
Aw, that's aww. All. I got all the feels now. Oh my gosh. All right, well, we better end this before I start
You can
crying.
Get a shot for that.
All right, folks, that is going to do it. Now come back next episode when we cover something completely different. And I mean very different. Because of you, yes, you Patreon supporters at home, you demanded it. The next episode we cover will be featuring the Justice League of America failed TV pilot. Oh, and woo-hoo! We'll have a few guest hosts to help me cover that train wreck. Who are they going to be? Come on, people. You know how this works. You're just going to have to wait and find out next episode. Thanks for listening, everybody. Until next time, I'm Shag.
I'm Jeff.
And I'm Tim.
And you've been listening to the JLI Podcast.
Want to make something of it?